Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. First of all, thanks to Lee and Jimmy there for what they were putting out just before I came on. That's really right up my street, that material. And my goodness, there's been a bit of it on PIR recently. We heard Lee and Vin discussing similar and related subjects not that long back. And Open Your Mind Radio had an interview with a man called Bob Fletcher talking about the incoming Nibiru. As it happens, I think that elements of all of that are going to turn up in tonight's show, because I have it in mind to talk about something that I've actually wanted to be talked about for quite a long time, because out in the real world, Synchro and I are involved in a project called the Template Ceremonies, which is something we've been doing for well over 15 years now. And I think the project itself has been kind of 28 years in the development, and it's sort of intimately connected really with Nibiru and all manner of these other subjects that have been talked about, and really was the start of my interest in some such subjects. In fact, it was the start, as we shall hear, I think, of my interest in many things. Probably about halfway through the show, we're going to have a little bit of quantum mechanics as well, because I think it might be helpful just to remember how weird the world is now looking to contemporary physicists, basically the queen of sciences. It sits at the centre of everything and has really had the floor pulled from under it over the last few years, last, what, 100 years or so. And a while back I found an article by Robert Anton Wilson, which I believe sums the state of things up pretty well. And I want to talk a little later about the first of the template ceremonies, the foundation ceremony. When we first came across it, it was not anticipated there were going to be any more. It was a really beautiful, simple experience. One day of, it was probably the most life-changing single day I think that I've ever experienced. In fact, I'm pretty sure it was. And subsequent to that, we've been working with that ceremony for quite a long time. And every single time we do it, every individual that comes along seems to be similarly impressed, not only by the ceremony, but by the material that accompanies it. And hopefully that story is going to develop, if I remember to get everything in. So we might well have alien contact, Nibiru, all sorts of things, really. And the idea of the electric human and the possibility that there might be energetic work that we can do to support the work that we're doing out in the real world. When the Dr. Rock Show started, this is now, I think, show 152, and I think we've been going for like 3.5 years or so. I had no idea that we'd be sticking it out for that long, I must admit. I really ended up on the radio in the first place, partly because of these ceremonies, because it was my love of geometry, which was entirely sparked off as a result of one of these experiences, and partly because of my interest in the Mayan calendar, which preceded this. And in fact, the Mayan calendars and the ceremonies are themselves intimately connected. But without those experiences, I probably wouldn't have ended up on the radio in the first place. So in a way, I'm kind of closing a loop here. I think one of the reasons why, although I've mentioned it in passing on a few shows, one of the reasons why I haven't actually concentrated on it is the thing has been continuing to develop, and it still does so. And Synchro and I went down to Glastonbury at the beginning of last December to catch up with the most recent ceremonies. In fact, we'd both had 4 or 5 years out, and it was during that time that I started doing the research into the background materials, into the subject matter that was first introduced to us. And it was also during that time, of course, that the Dr. Rock Show was born. And I kind of realised whilst we were in Glastonbury, first of all, that the project was really coming of age. And I'll be honest, we did have our doubts, especially being as we love the simplicity of the first thing. We were not too certain as to exactly where it was going, but both of us were completely floored by the experience of both the presentations and the new ceremonies and the amazing geometries that went with them. I haven't unfortunately had a chance to get any of the films I made together and into a presentable form, but at some stage we'll probably put some of those up so that you can see them as well. The show really has turned into a show that tends to concentrate on community consciousness and communication. That's largely because, as a result of all these experiences and my time kind of working at festivals and living in communities of all manner and sorts over the last again, sort of 15 years or so, I guess, has led to that being the core interest of my life. It's where my concentration has been. And again, the development of these particular interests sprung out of the effect that this first ceremony had on me. That's not to say, of course, that I'm not spending an awful lot of time listening to all of the amazing stuff that's coming out of people's internet radio. I've been paying very close attention to things like the official offer and return to sender, because I'm sure that eventually they're going to become useful to me as an individual. I'm hoping that eventually some of the people I know that are finding themselves at the blunt end of the stick, as it were, are going to start realizing that there's solutions that are available to them. It is a constant source of amazement to me that people, many, many people, are not only unaware of the solutions, but they are as yet, it would appear, completely unaware that there's any sort of problem at all. Now, I had had some experiences, such as the busting of Stonehenge by a bunch of really quite unfriendly policemen with their numbers all covered. There were several experiences like that which should have alerted me really to what was going on, but I kind of careered on regardless. And my first introduction really to the kind of things that we talk about on people's internet radio was in this first ceremony, which was called the Ceremony of Original Innocence. And funnily enough, I've only recently just kind of noticed that. It's only been whilst reviewing my experiences, the development of all of this stuff, that I realised that people's internet radio is, if you like, a kind of the real world end of what is, I guess, for want of a better word, it's a sacred experience, in that it kind of goes to the energetic heart of humans. So I think the official offer and return to sender are completely brilliant, really, because one of them deals fairly effectively with situations in which we might be deemed to have contract with somebody, and the other one deals pretty effectively with most of the situations in which we don't. And they're both such very simple things, which is one of the things I really love about people's internet radio. Is my earlier research has led me down all sorts of extremely complicated roads, which, because of an already complex lifestyle, I really didn't have enough time to get into or to understand, and I'm eternally grateful that I didn't spend too much time looking into that. And it seems to me that the people's internet radio solutions are going from strength to strength. Because, of course, there's also, if official offer deals with situations where there's a contract, and return to sender deals with situations where there isn't a contract, we also have a whole stack of really decent material about subject matter jurisdiction and how to avoid, at least how to try to avoid, ceding any kind of jurisdiction or getting yourself into contracts in which you might not want to be. And that's leads me on really to one of my absolute favourite parts of people's internet radio, which is listening to interviews, conversations with people who've been using the techniques and found them to be successful, or indeed not. That's another of its great strengths, I think, is that we now get to hear from people who've tried various methods and they haven't worked, and we get to have a look at what's been going on and learn ourselves as a result. In fact, it is said, isn't it, that there's nothing quite so successful as an unsuccessful hypothesis, that we learn a lot more from that than we do from the successful ones. But when I first got involved in all of this stuff, I was involved in a series of meetings that we called Lawful Solutions, for want of a better description. Everything has to have a label of some sort. And the whole idea of that was to endeavour to prevent people from making the same mistakes as others had made before them. They were attempts in which, for one reason or another, I think we signally failed. But all of this is really important, the business of how sometimes even the fictional paperwork can keep you out of a fair amount of trouble by dealing with it with some documents. Instead of having to turn up and deal with it live, you might at least buy yourself some time. You might actually get yourself out of some trouble in the first place. The business of simple advice I was once given, I think it wasn't advice, it was listening to Pat, I think, from Scotland Is Free, who was basically suggesting that denying title and trying to avoid having the courts involved at any cost was probably the best way to go. Again, pretty simple advice and possibly relatively easy to relatively easy to pull off in that if title can be denied, no names here today, sir, then a whole lot of grief can be avoided. And of course the use of passive language, which comes very much into my own sphere because, again, partly as a result of the ceremonies, partly as a result of the fact that I was realizing that, my own history had been really manipulated accidentally by people using pejorative language, sardonic humour, sarcasm, all sorts of things which really changed the energy of the way a conversation could go and sometimes caused people a great deal of discomfort. And whereas I used to spend quite a lot of time absolutely deliberately, and I admit this, I used to really enjoy winding people up, especially people who had particularly fixed ideas. Slowly but surely I came to the point where I realised that that was not in my interests. And it's not in interest, I don't think it's in the interest of anybody else either. So these were habits of thought that I started developing as a result of my work in communities, as a result of my socializing with other people and, trying to keep the goodwill rolling, as it were. All of these things are, I think, really, really important because they are our everyday life now. We're facing, as we know, so many huge challenges from the world management team. There's the money, which we don't need to go into. There's the banks, you know, who've done PPI and they've done split capital investment trusts and they've done endowments. They've done LIBOR rigging, all these other things, long lists of things that are called mis-selling and for which they get rescued rather than taken out of business. If any of us were to do anything even remotely approaching any of these things, then we would straight away be taken out of circulation. The little man is not allowed to get away with such things. But even these, it seems to me, are simply sops. They're like masks to hide the main con, which is the mortgages themselves, which of course are still going on, and I think with the honourable exception of Michael of Benicia, nobody as far as I know has had very much success in trying to deal with what is basically, I think, just the biggest, not only rip-off in terms of money, but it's also the means by which our ability to generate our own wealth, our own wealth, is being deprived of us, deprived from us, and also our ability to find ourselves land on which to grow veg, land on which to develop projects, land on which we might well be able to, you know, meet and hang out and all that. There's so much space out there which most of us are not able to get any access to and find ourselves instead kind of all clustered together in the cities and the like. It is something that I personally would really like to see change because the control of dwellings, the control of land, and the desperate control or the imposition of constant and persistent need to pay and pay again and pay again for these things is meaning that we get separated from each other. It means that it's extremely difficult for us to get together in a place with plenty of buildings, plenty of different rooms and spaces, which otherwise we could turn up and use our skills in and start cooperating and working together, amassing a few materials and seeing just exactly what happened when we wired one thing to another. On a smaller scale, Synchro was in the local building suppliers recently. I was, it doesn't matter, I think, how long you're doing this stuff. You still come across things that really make you turn pale. This is a really little thing where you just kind of, when you're used to hearing what we're hearing and talking about what we're talking about, you start to see the symptoms of what's going on all around you. And Jess went in there because she wanted to buy a wee rasp. It's kind of like a little cheese grater on a plastic handle. It's ever so tiny. I think it's only about, 3 centimetres by 3 centimetres. And it's used for, well, Synchro's using it for removing the bark from honeysuckle-entwined hazel sticks that she's finding in the woods to turn out really beautiful staves. And she also wanted to buy a bow saw blade because the other one, presumably due to mistreatment, had become blunt. And she was told by the man, she was asked by the man behind the counter whether she was over 16. He was, of course, I think only partly joking, but apparently you can't buy the rasp unless you're over 16 anymore. But these things you would seriously have to work really hard to do yourself or anybody else any damage with this thing. You stand more chance of doing yourself damage with a cheese grater, which I assume, I mean, I haven't checked, but I assume you can still buy cheese graters if you're under 16. So that was astonishing. Perhaps even more astonishing is the fact that you don't need to be under 16 to buy the bowsaw blade. So it's not only that it's petty and it's, I mean, I don't know, offering, it's just preventing people from having the opportunity to learn. It's also inconsistent and confusing, because I don't know how many of you out there have ever used a new bowsaw blade, but if you have it pointing the wrong way up in the back of your van and you so much as glance your hand off a new bowsaw blade, it will inflict significant woundage on you. There's some quite fair subdual damage. There'll be a fair bit of blood. If you actually lean on the damn thing, then you are going to end up with some fairly significant holes in your hand for quite a while. So there you go. You need to be over 16 to buy this tiny poxy little rasp, but you can have a bowsaw blade without that rule applying. It even vouchsafe, this man behind the counter, even vouchsafe the information that if you want to buy a tape measure, one of these ones that kind of recoils back into its body, sort of thing that I use all the time, if you want one that's above a given size and has above a given spring strength in it, then you got to be over 16 to buy one of those as well. So there's all sorts of insane legislation coming in that people believe is law. And it means that, you know, people, young lads and stuff who want to go out and maybe do carpentry courses or whatever, have got to take their parents in order to be able to buy the basic kit that they need. We got Europe again. I heard about this on Pat's show on Scotland is Free. And I went looking for it. Once again, there is this proposition of putting a wealth tax out there and simply taking, as far as I can gather, 10% off people of the value of whatever it is that they own, which is absolutely shocking. Well, I mean, it's not shocking, but I mean, it's going to come as a bit of a surprise to people if that's what occurs. I think that such things have been tried before, and what tends to happen is that you're truly wealthy, find it not too difficult to avoid that sort of thing. And once again, it will come piling down on the heads of the people who don't have the advice or the resources to be able to shunt things around and hide them. Perhaps the most astonishing thing, really, that I've heard recently to do with the real world side of all of this is the canons of positive law that Pat's been talking about on his show, Roman law. It is the dictionary of dictionaries. I haven't got the link to hand, unfortunately, and I find it very difficult to talk at the same time as keep an eye on the chat box and do any cutting and pasting, but I think that hopefully somebody will put it in there for me, because it really is the devil's dictionary. In a way, I'm really grateful that it turned up, because it really does kind of show what's behind the whole shooting match, the whole game. I find it very difficult myself to believe that the world can believe that a pope in the Middle Ages can put out a bull taking control of the entire planet and then taking control of all the people and then eventually taking ownership of all their souls as well. It just boggles my mind to think that anybody can believe that to be effective. But somehow, when you look at these canons of positive law and get to see what the background is behind all of this stuff, then it really brings it home. And it really makes it clear as well, the kind of things we've been hearing about to do with registration and all that kind of stuff. It shows you really how, where it comes from, and takes you right down, if you like, to the roots of this incredible tree that's been grown out of the whole thing. So all of that is important, and I find all of it very interesting, and I'm working hard at taking as much of it as I can on board. As Jimmy Hagan was saying to John McSee in his show, I think it was the 27th of December, another really great PIR show, actually. You can't really tell how it's all going to work in reality, but it's only by paying attention, by hearing the same stuff again and again from different voices, by hearing different approaches, that we're going to stand any chance at all. But it is work that is absolutely essential, because the net is closing around us, and knowing how to deal with it, or at least having some sort of, I don't know, I guess, prepared game plan is much, much better, I think, well, I'm assuming it is anyway, than having the whole thing just leap on you and you having to deal with it out of your own resources. The thing is that I don't think it's the only important work that needs to be done. There've been many Dr. Rock shows and many other shows as well on people's internet radio that are looking hard at the nature of consciousness, at things like meditation. We've had a few shows on that as well as diet and things like that. But the basic energetic nature of the human, of the man or woman, of the living soul incarnate, as it were, is, I think, as important as the physical being itself, the one that's out there dealing with the roadside stop and using its vocal cords or its pencil and paper to do the best that it can. And it's really the energetic side of it that I want to talk about a bit tonight. The basic premise of the template ceremonies is that a long, long time ago, human beings were modified. And this is believed by a lot of people. It was something that I think it was the first I'd heard of it when I actually came across these things. But once I started looking into it, I discovered that there are actually several pretty credible sources out there who are willing to go along this line. And of course, you know, there are billions of us on the planet, apparently, and each of us believe different things. The idea was that a planet called Nibiru, might be a planet, might not, exists in our solar system as an additional planetary mass, or maybe even a small solar system all of its own, and that it's on a highly elliptical orbit, that it comes in every 3,600 years and causes huge amounts of carnage in the solar system. This is one of the subjects that was covered in some detail. I was thinking about doing this show this week anyway. In fact, I was preparing for it before I saw that Bob Fletcher was on Open Your Mind show, Alan and Steve talking to Bob about Nibiru, and he'd had his attention attracted to it. Oh, go and catch the pod. It's really well worth listening to. And this man has actually spent 3 years looking into this subject and, it seems, talking to as many people as he can find who know about it and who've looked into it themselves. I was, of course, already aware that nearly every single ancient people on the planet, from the Maya to whoever it was who put the Bible together, have mentioned this entity in one form or another. These catastrophic incursions into the solar system and into Earth's immediate space have been recognized over many thousands of years by many, many peoples in living memory. Well, not living memory, sorry, in historical times. So there have been people around who've been able to record it, either in pictographic form on rocks or in quite a lot of cases in writing. I think it's certainly something that the Maya knew a fair about. Of course, we will never know that, because one of the first things the Spanish priests did when they turned up in the Maya lands was burnt all of their books. But one of the things that they were very particular about was keeping track of the movements of the stars and the planets in the sky. And that is largely what their surviving manuscripts actually deal with. And Bob was very clear about the thing. He said quite honestly that he hoped they could have him on in a year's time and, just have a good laugh about how stupid he'd been. But he did emphasize a fair few things which have all been on my research list for the last several years. The fact that the planets in the solar system are already changing. The fact that several of the outer planets have strange imperfections in their orbit, which caused astronomers to go looking for what it was that was causing these imperfections. And as a result of that and a lot of detailed work, they discovered, for example, Pluto. They discovered Ceres, C-E-R-E-S. They discovered several things that were, in fact, very, very tiny. And shows how hard they were looking, in my opinion. That's how I felt about these things. And it would appear that a number of them found other things out there, and several of the people who managed to were on their way to documenting that sort of thing have come to mysterious and untimely ends. The planets are changing. I know that because one of my favourite YouTube video channels covers it a lot. They're called Suspicious Observers. Well worth keeping an eye on. They watch the sun for solar flares, and they look to the Earth to see how these flares relate to earthquakes and strange weather conditions and various other things. They've also been paying quite a lot of attention to the large number of comets we seem to have had over the last 5 years or so, and the fact that whenever some body approaches the sun, what we seem to get is an increased number of solar flares, and they're increased in size as well. This subject also touches on the subject of 2012, the purported Mayan end date, so-called, and it wasn't really an end date. The Maya have themselves recorded several extinction-level events where the world ended in either fire or flood, and it was believed that December, widely believed anyway, that December 21st, 2012 was a specific date that was related to this. I don't think that's actually how it came about, but we don't have time to go into that right now. I do begin to suspect, having listened to Bob Fletcher talking though, that one of the reasons why the focus was put on 2012, when nothing of this major sort happened anyway, there might have been energetic changes. I know many people who believe that there were. But the fact that it didn't happen then might well leave people to breathe a sigh of relief and think, oh, well, that's that then. The fact that it was probably not an accurate date that was put out there, and quite possibly not predictable to quite that extent, although according to Bob, people have got specific historical dates when these things occurred. His argument is that we've still got it coming. Now, before I heard all of this, I'd been looking into the work of a character called Marshall Masters, who was also referred to in the Bob Fletcher interview. There's a lot of people out there apparently saying that he might be some kind of shill or false information or whatever, but he has got up there an image which purports to come from a place called the South Polar Telescope, which is in an ideal position apparently to see this sort of thing going on. And what it shows is not a planet. It would appear, at least if it's a genuine photo and genuinely leaked from the SPT, what it actually shows is a dying sun with a planet, and the planet's got several moons, which is much, much more consistent with the descriptions of the ancient Sumerians of what they believe happened than it is with the idea of a single planet. Anyway, the idea is that Nibiru comes piling by sometime a long, long time ago, maybe 400,000 years ago, and on it are a bunch of people, a bunch of entities known as the Anunnaki, and they came to Earth a long time ago, apparently to mine gold. That's what it was for, so we're told. But whilst here, they modified genetically some of the entities that they found here. This is the kind of basis of the template ceremonies that a long, long time ago we were messed around with, and that as a result we are nothing like the beings that we were, A, before this happened, or perhaps like the beings that we would have become. This is put forward as an explanation for why it is that only some 3 or 4% of our DNA is currently functional, that out of 6,000 million base pair chemicals, only some 30 million are actually functional at the moment. It's also said that, relatively speaking, we use very little of our brains, which means that we have perhaps only a few of the cognitive facilities that might have originally been designed in. Now, of course, the ceremony folk aren't the only folk to believe this. Zachariah Sitchin's one of the main names in the field, and I read his entire oeuvre as a result of meeting the template people. He's a pretty dry writer. He repeats himself a lot, and the template people themselves say it's quite difficult to sort out what's information and what's incorrect amongst it. It is possible, though, to get a good summary of what he was writing about simply by reading Genesis Revisited, which is something he wrote after his main body of work. There's also a lot of the people out there writing on this subject have actually read Sitchin and seem to be turning out his stuff more or less verbatim or with slight modifications. They may, of course, have done all the research themselves and, I don't know, looked at all the ancient documents or what have you. But there are one or two that appear to be independent. One of my favourites were a pair called Christian and Joy O'Brien. They wrote a book called The Genius of the Few, which covers this, and it's got different interpretations of what the Anunnaki were at, but basically the idea of genetic modification of critters found on this beautiful blue ball when they arrived, and serial modification as well, not just once and then leaving. So Genius of the Few, though, I think it was a bit of a shame I got that. It was quite an expensive book. In fact, the one that I think I should have got was called The Shining Ones. I believed that The Shining Ones was actually a different book, but in fact, it turns out that The Genius of the Few is a kind of redacted version what they appear to have done is put the stuff that they felt was not going to be too unacceptable to orthodoxy into a book and sold that, and then The Shining Ones is the full text. I've since seen a copy of that, and I can probably borrow it, hopefully. I've just seen that Unique Lee's put in New Age's Faux Enlightenment. It has the opposite effect. You become empty and vacuous. That is, that's extremely timely. Thanks very much, Lee, because that is exactly one of the subjects that was covered in the ceremonies that we went to last December. The fact that the New Age is effectively keeping people in denial. One of the things that I think is right on about the template is that it doesn't do that. It is definitely not saying what people want to hear. And in fact, as people work their way through the process, the first ceremony is really beautiful and more or less unobjectionable to anybody, although it does introduce a lot of the material we talk about here. By the time you get to the other ceremonies, people are starting to become really quite disturbed by the material, and that is because there is an attempt to deal with tradition, there's an attempt to deal with theology, there's an attempt to deal with the catastrophic past of our solar system. And it seems to me, and again, it's only really as a result of kind of integrating and thinking about all of this stuff over the last 4 or 5 weeks that I've sort of realized it. It seems to me that the people who are being disturbed by this material are exactly the people who are coming into it having no idea of the no-fit state that they're actually living in. So the whole thing is coming as a hell of a shock. Those people, and they are in increasing number now, who are approaching these things and similar technologies, I would imagine, with some idea of just exactly where it is we're living and what's being done to us, are actually much less perturbed. Myself and Synchro's response to the information and the ceremonies was one of tremendous relief, actually, and we were not even vaguely disturbed by it, which is one of the reasons why I've finally chosen to try and do something with it. So there are another couple of books that I'd like to mention, actually. One of them, there was a really great picture that Lee had in a slideshow that he put up showing the passage of a body that was called Phaeton in that particular case, but it's got many names. And the book was called When the Earth Nearly Died. I hadn't come across it before. I saw it whilst I was in Glastonbury last December. It just happened to be sitting on the table in the house where I was staying whilst we were doing this work. And it is, I think, a fabulous book. I've got collections of peer-reviewed scientific anomalies, though I've got quite a lot of stuff about the strange order in which geological strata appear on Earth and several other kind of anomalous things that don't really fit the orthodox model, not entirely surprisingly, in my opinion. The thing about when the Earth nearly died is that it is a pretty exhaustive. It has a pretty exhaustive survey of these geological anomalies. Its full title is When the Earth Nearly Died, Compelling Evidence of Catastrophic World Change, 9500 BC. And it's by D.S. Allen and J.B. Dallaire. And I did manage to whip my way through that whilst I was staying in Glastonbury, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And we keep getting more of these things to look at. Anyway, the idea is that rather than ignoring all of this stuff or not even knowing that it's happening, it does form the very basis of the template ceremonies and what it is they're trying to deal with. It's, if you like, a transcendent model which acknowledges all of this stuff and endeavours to address and utilise what we know about the miraculous nature of the human and indeed all critters on Earth as entities of light. It's again not something that we have time to go into at the moment, but I was referring to the intention experiment last week by Lynn McTaggart. There's quite a good review in there of the electrical nature of humans, the fact that when healers heal, there are huge electrostatic surges that can be measured coming from their fingers. Other people like Fritz Albert Popp took a different approach to this and had a look and found that there's light as well as electrostatic charge. There is light that flows from the fingers of healers, especially from their dominant hand. There have also been investigations which have shown that there's magnetism coming out as well, that there are fairly huge, in fact really big, fluctuations in the magnetic field around the hands of people that are healing. So all of this deals with the human entity as a synchrony, if you like, of multiple frequencies, which when they all come together are actually highly ordered. In fact, there's now some suggestion that human thought forms a similar highly ordered state in the brain, and it's been likened to superfluidity and superconductivity in the quantum world, where many subatomic particles get to behave like one giant particle. I think investigations have been done as well to show that this works on the molecular level as well. So many molecules can start behaving like they're one giant smeared out molecule. So although we appear to be simply a physical being who can only talk and listen through the ears and see through the eyes, it would appear that one of our primary means of communication is via light, via photons. So we kind of came into this. I had steadfastly avoided getting involved in complementary therapies or real healing, as Karma Singh called it the other week, because complementary is a bit of an insulting term, especially when you consider what it's a compliment to. But eventually I got myself engaged to go and help out at a Maya Dreamtime Festival in Glastonbury, and we did three of those. They were my first introduction to ceremony outside church, which I'd given up quite a long time before that. And I really enjoyed the ceremonies. One of the things that I liked about them most of all was that they really brought people together in a space. I think at the first one we had 52 odd people. There were somewhere over 100 in the second one. And the ceremonies were a really grand way of getting people to cooperate with people, and in fact getting them from the word go to sort of know each other, to be together, even though they'd never really met before. That was one of the first things that struck me about them. There were several ceremonies that were performed over those 3 years that I really didn't get on with at all. In fact, there was one of them that I fled from. I still remember it. It's funny, some of these, there's loads of things I don't remember, but some of these experiences really stayed with me. This particular one was run by an American lady and was a sword and chalice ritual of some sort, with plenty of really handsome blonde blokes and blonde ladies and the rest, and I was just repelled. So I also got to experience some ceremonies with which I really wasn't very impressed at all. Anyway, I've just got a cup of coffee here, excuse me a moment. After the third Maya Dreamtime ceremony, which was the last for a while actually, we went to a place called the Earth Spirit Camp outside Glastonbury and got engaged in what was for me at that stage fairly surreal activity. We did a kind of guide finding exploration using meditation and cards. And I was pretty blown away because I'd had a strange dream about bats the night before, where I was lying on a sleeping mat in the middle of a huge gymnasium, and there was a single bat flying around in the roof space in this dream. And by the end of the dream, the place was full of bats, and they were lying all over me. In the dream, I was looking down on myself, and I couldn't see myself anymore because I was covered in bats. And I was quite surprised when in the guide finding ceremony, I selected out of all the possible alternatives, what turned up for me was a bat. There's been a lot of that sort of thing going on since I got engaged in this sort of work, and that was a particularly high impact moment for me. But we did lots of other things. We did a sweat lodge. That was my first and so far only sweat lodge. I think I'd be prepared to approach another one now, a kind of rebirth process, but it was all too hot and unpleasant for me. We did an earth healing ceremony at Avebury, which I really enjoyed again. I enjoyed that particularly because I felt it was a useful thing to be doing. It was a beautiful ceremony. And because several members of the public who were visiting, I guess tourists or whatever, got involved as well. Which is another thing about ceremonies, when one gets involved in them, is that they can be incredibly inclusive, which I think is a good way of starting to overcome the separation that we experience as we move through this savage society. And then on the Friday afternoon, this pair, Juliet and Jeeva Carter, turned up to do this thing called the Ceremony of Original Innocence. That was basically the last thing that was going to happen in this week before we went home. And Juliet gave, I guess, what was about an hour's introduction. And that was the moment, that was the 60 minutes which really changed things for me. I was absolutely gobsmacked by what she was talking about. She was talking about Nibiru. She was talking about the Anunnaki. She was talking about the electromagnetic disconnection of the human entity from the holographic cosmos in which it exists. It was absolutely astonishing, and my hair stand on end still, remembering it even now. I did, in the end, manage to get an audio cassette of this particular presentation. She gave it without notes, which is how she does present things, actually. It's very engaging. It means that what's coming out is what's needed at the moment, and this particular chat was like stuff I had been waiting to hear for years. It was like the unlocking of a door inside myself. Now, it wasn't all comfortable, as I'd really like to emphasize about this process. There were several points in there which I really did find quite disturbing. That she was talking about the world management team and the effect that it was having on the people of the world. She was talking about paedophilia, which then seemed to me to be outrageous. I'll be honest, it seemed to me to be an outrageous claim. It's been running as a kind of core through the whole thing. But now, of course, I realise that it's far from outrageous, and that there was a bit of me that wished that it wasn't being talked about in that particular context. But that's just part and parcel of the thing. So all of that stuff came up there, and subsequent to that, every single thing that was mentioned in that initial introduction has come to be a key part of the discourse on people's internet radio and in other places that I frequent. So places like Truth Juice, places like New Horizons up in Blackpool. It turns out that there are lots and lots of people doing research into this stuff, but at that stage it was completely news to me. So most of all, I felt an intense enthusiasm for this particular project, really from the moment I came across it. And it was the first thing for many, many years that had attracted me that way. And I think that it changed a lot of the ways that I approach the world. And I think it changed a lot of the way that I do things. The basic claim that was being made in this introduction was that there are 12 electromagnetic circuits in the human body, each of which had a kind of test point associated with various bits of the physical entity, and that these circuits had been originally connected to the elemental heart of creation, i.e. to the classic elements, to water, air, earth, fire, and ether. And the proposition was that these circuits were going to be reconnected by a ceremony that was going to be done in the afternoon. All of that sounded really grand to me, and I, as I'm sure many people are, am basically used to having claims made and kind of doing the stuff and then going away and maybe not having anything demonstrated in any kind of empirical fashion. But what happened next was really great. They asked for a volunteer to go and stand with them on their little presentation dais, and they demonstrated using kinesiology, muscle testing, which I hadn't come across before either. That was another new experience that afternoon. They demonstrated, first of all, that certain muscles in the body become weak when you put your fingers on the test points for the various of the 12 circuits, and that they could be strengthened using external props. So, for example, the earth circuit, which is a couple of inches, it's about 3 fingers above where your spine goes into your head. So there's a little soft bit, a little soft indentation at the back. If you put 3 fingers just above that soft indentation, the earth circuit's just where the third finger will be. Put 3 fingers on that spot and do a muscle test on yourself, having set yourself up for kinesiology or get a kinesiologist to do it. You will find that the muscle test's weak. If you, however, look at an earth crystal, the muscle goes strong again. this is particularly, we've done a lot of this testing, being as we now do this ceremony, and one of the things we like to do is show people a bit of iron pyrites, show people, I don't know, whatever earth crystals you've got, bit of quartz, bit of rose quartz, any of these things, and they will all strengthen the earth circuit, and you can go look away, and the circuit, the muscle goes weak, you go look towards the crystal, and it goes strong again. The really funny thing about that, and the template has been full of these experiences, which is another reason why I like it, is if you show the individual that you're testing a piece of moldavite, their earth circuit will test weak, even if they don't know what moldavite is. Now, there are various theories about it. Some say that it's the result of a Martian meteorite crashing to Earth and mixing with the sand of Earth. So it's not properly an Earth crystal. Some people disagree with that and say it's not Martian, but comes from somewhere else, I think. Planet Marduk or something like that, which supposedly got blown up at some point in our catastrophic past. But anyway, one way or the other, moldavite is acknowledged to be not entirely an earth stone, and as a result it doesn't strengthen the earth circuit. And the really funny thing is that so far, completely unfailingly, I've managed to slip moldavite into this little test routine that we do with people every time we do this ceremony, and every time the individual will test weak with the moldavite, even if they don't know that it's in any way different from the other stones they're being shown. The fire circuit gets reconnected by looking at fire, so we use a candle flame for that. And all 12 circuits were demonstrated in front of this group. And again, I fired up as I was by the information that had been given to me beforehand. I didn't realise at the time that a whole, what appears to be a lifetime's mission was being set up, but it was the first time I'd ever actually seen such spectacular claims actually validated in any sense at all. And there was no doubt from watching the face of the individual who'd volunteered to be tested in front of the group, there was no doubt at all that what was going on was genuine. The first thing that happens is people's eyes widen and they look at the individual that's doing the testing as if to say, what? How on earth are you doing that? And that in itself is actually quite interesting, because you are somehow questioning this kind of inner navigator. There's something in there, inside us, that is giving some kind of electromagnetic or doused response, whatever it is, energetic response to a kind of outside stimulus. And as a result of that, I did go on a weekend training course for kinesiology, and since then have tested probably hundreds of people myself with either the crystals or the fire or the geometries that are associated with them. We didn't know that there was going to be any geometry involved in any of the ceremonies. It turned out to be completely key. But of course, what we didn't recognise at this early stage was that water, air, earth, fire and ether all have their own geometric forms associated with them. They're called Platonic forms, after Plato, although Plato probably got them from Pythagoras, but Pythagoras, who didn't write anything down, probably, they were known about a long, long time ago. There's very ancient crystal Platonic forms that are being carved, and they found some very interesting variations on Platonic forms up at Scarabray. I'm not sure it's known how old they are. But of course, that means that subsequently, as we discovered that geometry was central to all of this, we found that the earth circuit can not only be connected by looking at a crystal, it can also be connected by looking at a cube, which is the Platonic form for earth. The fire circuit can be reconnected by looking at fire, or it can be reconnected by looking at a tetrahedron, the Platonic symbol for fire. And at no stage have any of these tests failed in all of the times that I've been doing the ceremonies. It still kind of freaks me out a little bit, still weirds me out, the kinesiology, and I still find myself getting a little bit nervous at that point in the day where it's necessary to get a volunteer up. And we have had some fairly cynical people in the room, not only me and Synchro, but Juliet and Jeeva have as well. I remember one occasion when a guy who really was very dubious about the whole thing, and frankly, folks, who can blame him, was the one who volunteered to do the demonstration muscle testing. And the same thing happened with him as happened with everybody else, in that straight away he realised that something was going on that was beyond his ken. I've even had people who told me after the ceremony that they planned to come along and prove to me that what we were saying was bunkum. And somehow, somewhere along the process, their minds had been changed. Perhaps we've just been really, really lucky. I don't know. But, 15 years of this now. And also all of that lunchtime, they test everybody's circuits, which means that having seen somebody else tested, you get the chance whilst everybody else is having something to eat to experience what it's like, this bit of kinesiology. And that also is quite an eye-opening experience. And it's all followed by a beautiful and simple ceremony, which only really takes about 20 minutes. And it's something that I'm going to go into in a bit more detail, hopefully later in the show. So, as I say, it was my first introduction to the actual state of the world, although I had had a few experiences which really should have woken me up. They were violent and gross enough. And there was television in those days. I'm not that old. And there was the Vietnam War going on. There were a whole load of things happening. But it was really the first time somebody had actually flagged up in such blatant terms the existence of the World Management Team, the existence of paedophilia rings, the fraudulent nature of the gods, and what it was they actually represented, what priests were, what they were doing, that history might well not be anything like the history that I'd been taught at school. And that was that was total news to me. Bit embarrassing to admit now, but hey, I guess we're all kind of like that once, weren't we? My first discovery that there is 97% of our DNA is apparently junk. It was the first time I came across the fact that we're only making very limited use of our brain, and that maybe there's a huge number of cognitive facilities that are not being made use of or are not even being noticed by humans. Partly because they're entirely distracted, but partly the argument is because they have been disconnected and become disconnected from the actual energetic world of which they are a fractal part. So, that was the first time I came across all of that stuff, and I don't have to tell the people that are listening to this show that it's all pretty central to people's internet radio, one way or the other. Lots and lots of this stuff comes up in various shows, and in fact, it's one of the things I particularly enjoy about people's internet radio is the variety of material that's now coming across. So, for me, the template model itself, the actual ceremonies, the work that we do when we go to Glastonbury, or when we go about the country just doing ceremonies in people's living rooms, which is the way we prefer to do it, it actually addresses really the sacred, holographic, energetic processes that underlie every single one of us as individuals. They kind of address the light that energizes things and the miraculous organism that's the cosmos, and the whole organisms, everything from bacteria through birds, planets, solar systems and galaxies, that are the parts that the whole thing is comprised of. Whereas here on PIR and previously on MSI and TNS, we're investigating the, for want of a better word, the physical manifestations of control that seem to arise from eons old misappropriation of our miraculous substructure and the resonances and signals that form the bedrock of which it's all manufactured. So it's only in recent weeks, really, that for me, all of this has become one experience. Up to that point, the template, the ceremonies, and indeed ceremonies generally, because I think many of the ceremonies that I've done, we do opening ceremonies at festivals, we do clearing ceremonies for healing spaces at festivals. But like I say, the template was a completely separate thing. It's like a difference between the sacred and the profane, if you like. What we're doing on PIR, as far as I was concerned, was the profane end of it. And the ceremony is a completely different kind of sacred, heart-based, energy-based activity that I chose to engage in. But now, suddenly, it's all become kind of one thing. And for many years, this has really been my experience of the world. It's, I guess, why it is that I talk about what I talk about and why it is that I meet the people that I meet who generously agree every now and then to come onto the show and be conversed with. But that first encounter with the template, as I said, was probably the biggest and most life and attitude and mind-changing experience of all. And I have had a fair few. And it was a bit like that. It really did feel like change on that kind of level, a change of mind, a change of emotions, a change in the body. Most everything that's happened since has been, in some sense, a revelatory aspect of that original investigation. Now, I'm still amazed that somebody can put together one little 1 hour presentation, which is so packed with stuff. And I still use that. Synchro and I still use very much that original presentation. When we're out doing ceremonies, that is what I tend to stick to, because the template itself has become, as I said, quite large and complex. But the interesting thing for me is that everything that we're talking about now, all the stuff that is alternately comforting and shocking people, was packed into that original presentation, even though nobody knew at that point that it was going to be anything other than a single beautiful standalone experience. So for the last 15 years, Synchro and I have been celebrating this ceremony of original innocence, as I said, with many widely different individuals. And we see time and again similar changes wrought in others. We never see anybody who is dismissive of it, and we certainly never get people who take us up on our offer of a full refund and being able to leave with, you know, pockets still intact. Over these years, hundreds of people have taken part with us, and thousands more with the very few other template representatives there are, scattered around the UK, some in the US, some in Australia, and some of it goes on in Bali as well. But as I said, in our experience, no one has been anything less than completely satisfied. And many of them are completely amazed by the experience. I'm still amazed by it. I'm still totally amazed by it. And I've been hammering away at this. I don't know how well it's coming across, really, what kind of job I'm doing at telling you about it. Or indeed whether it make any difference, really. It's just that we've heard a lot of stuff about energies. We know a lot from the healing. We know a lot from the influence of meditation and things like that. We know that we're energetic systems. It's just that one way or the other, luck, coincidence, synchronicity, whatever it was, threw this thing in my path in a small group of people a long, long time ago, such that really we've been part of the core team, although absent for 4 or 5 years. We have been part of the core team more or less since it came to the fore. So the madness of the money and all the other things that was described at the beginning of this, the speed with which psychopathic control is being implemented by the emotionally lights, or elites as they're called, the horror that's being visited upon the miraculous entities that are the current manifestations of consciousness, because of course we're just the latest, as the previous passages of Nibiru have resulted in large-scale extinction sometimes of almost everything that's on the planet. We are simply the latest manifestation, but it is my belief that it grows each time. But the kind of horror that's being visited on us here, not just the people either, but the animals and the plants that are being trapped and farmed and genetically modified or driven to extinction largely by power and greed, has really led to Synchro and I recommitting to this aspect of our mission, I think, and also recommitting to the radio show, because that takes a lot of effort. And as things become more and more uncertain and more kind of impoverished, we seem to be doing things on less and less, more or less by the day. But the two things that I remain really committed to at this stage, because of the acceleration in the pace of change and because of just the blatant fraud and manipulation and assault and battery that is going on. So the template really addresses our electromagnetic nature. It addresses our traumatized history, our delinquent DNA, our collective consciousness. As it goes on, it has a go at the role of tradition, which is one of the things that really upsets people. But of course, tradition, folks, is definitely one of the things that has us seriously, seriously conditioned and habitual in the way we behave and the way we talk. And I guess if you haven't come towards realizing that, it seems that people who have a go at tradition might be attacking you as an individual. They might be attacking your Englishness in your mind, or your Scottishness, or maybe your Buddhist nature or something like that. It's a big step for people to take to realize that part of what we might call claiming your sovereignty what we might call taking responsibility for what you're doing involves looking very hard at some traditional behavior, a lot of which is habitual and some of which might, I think, not unreasonably be called addiction. Template approaches our understanding of the gods fairly early on, which is a bit of a problem for some people, because again, if you've got the little Shiva around you, or the little picture of the Egyptian temple, or whatever it is on the wall, or your little Buddha, all of these things, I mean, they're great. I'm not actually criticizing any of it, but to a certain extent, if these things are being given any power at all, then it is your power that is being given. And actually, when that subject came up, we took the opportunity of using the kinesiology, the muscle testing, to have a look at what some of these things like the little Shivas and Buddhas and things actually did. Because you can test yourself for anything. You can see if your muscle's strong, and then you can look at one of these things and see if it goes weak. It'll tell you. In fact, I think it was one of Vin's guests, or it might have been one of Clive DeCarl's, can't remember. But one of them pointed out that doing the blessing, the traditional Western Christian self-blessing, the Catholic one where you touch your forehead or your crown chakra, you touch your navel, touch your heart, and touch the plates that's just opposite the heart in the form of a cross, that doing that will actually weaken you in a kinesiological test. And what we discovered was that actually nearly everything that people brought in to have a look at, be it a Shiva or a Buddha or whatever, would weaken your electromagnetic response as a result of looking at it. And when you looked away again, you'd once again become strong once you were standing again in your own power. So the only things that didn't do that, one of them was a unicorn, which I thought was quite good. The unicorn didn't cause any weakness, because I guess it's just a fanciful creation, or just something that's gone missing. The other thing that didn't cause too much disturbance, if I remember rightly, was a little Buddha. One of the Buddhas did, the other of the Buddhas didn't. But the Buddha that didn't cause any problem was actually made out of crystal, an earth crystal. So it's just possible that that the circuit was, that it was the crystal that was being looked at and not the Buddha. Anyway, so, and eventually, we end up having a look at not just the gods with a small g and what we might call idols, because, one person's god is another person's idol. It all depends on your point of view. But eventually, of course, it becomes necessary to look at the nature of God. Many, many people are convinced that, one way or the other, that there's something between the creator and them, and these things get called sometimes God with a capital G. It also becomes necessary eventually to look at the constellations. They're not called that for nothing, eh? And the fact that when you look at them, they're not actually constellations at all, that they're pretty random bundles of stars that can actually be quite a long way away from each other. Some of them, because they might be in the same area of the sky, apparently, but it can be a long, long way, further way away or closer to you. I once saw down at the planetarium in London, they had a kind of big starscape in front of you, and as you walked in, it looked completely unfamiliar. Well, they had a tiny little red spot on the ground. It was just about big enough for you to fit your feet into. You go and put your feet into this red circle. And when you were standing there, you could see Orion. You could see the constellation that we know as Orion with the three stars along its belt. And as soon as you stepped any distance outside that red circle at all, Orion disappeared. So for a start off, it's all about a perspective. It's where you're standing. But quite apart from the fact that the stars are a long, long way away from each other and not really in any kind of proximity at all, there's also the fact that whoever it was that did the dot-to-dot on them appears to have been incredibly inventive. If you did actually have people telling you that Sagittarius was some guy with a bow, I think you would be extremely hard-pressed to pull that out. Now, actually, standing up time and again and doing workshops where you're going to require people to check their idols, where you're going to require people to check that astrology is what it says it is. That's not to say it hasn't got some validity, but it might well have come from elsewhere. It might well be another thing, because the number of people who, if you ask them, explain their behavior by saying, oh, I'm Aries with Virgo rising or whatever, It's really deeply inset, and also it lies behind all of the ages that are being visited upon us. So the age of Pisces, the age of a ram, the Aquarian age. We're aware that the Vatican is currently busily taking apart the Piscean con, presumably in order to replace it with the Aquarian con. So it's worthy of looking at, but you're not going to get people to question something that's as deep set as the constellations and the zodiac and whatever we want to call it, the horoscope, the astrological world, without treading on a fair few toes. And that's one of the things that I was trying to say to Lee's comments earlier on, that the New Age does seem to be more and more trying to tell people the things it wants to hear. It's trying to say, you know, ignore the bad stuff, because by concentrating on it, you're making it happen. Well, people are not making paedophilia happen by concentrating on it. People are enabling paedophilia to happen by not recognizing it and by not taking some sort of responsibility for it. So it's another thing I think that distinguishes the template from other things, is that it is not afraid of disturbing the comfortable, although it does have a fair few aspects of comforting the disturbed. Well, I think I ought to have a quick look at the chat box, so I'm going to put on a little bit of music before seeing where it is that I'm going to go to next with this. I'm going to put a bit of music on whilst I decide what I'm going to do next, folks. So here comes Fudge Knuckle and No Sugar. Haha, yeah, indeed, why not? Let's do that. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. That was the Georgia Satellites and Battleship Chains. You got us tied down with Battleship Chains. Well, ain't that right? Before that, Jefferson Airplane. Stop Children, What's That Sound? Take a little look what's going down. I'd like to thank Simon Spaniard for reminding me about that one. That's pretty pertinent, I think, really. And before that, Fudge Knuckle, as I said, and No Sugar. By the way, after Space Station Number 5 by Montrose that I played at the beginning of the show, I genuinely had that one lined up before I heard what Lee and Jimmy were talking about. After that, I played a version of the Guns of Brixton, which I discovered the other day, which I really liked, by the Inner Terrestrials. A lot of people seem to have done that. That was a particularly cracking version. And the third tune I played before I started chattering away was Horace X's Balkan Confusion. I'm in between wandering up for a bit of a break and things like that. I've had a bit of time to look through the chat box, but not very much. Seems to be a lot of activity in there. It's great to see so many people in. Pretty much on topic as well, as far as I can tell. What I'm going to do now, before I go on, to give you a bit of a break from my voice, this is another thing that I wanted to do for some time, is I've been wanting to play Beyond Theology and the Science of Godmanship. It seems to be a particularly suitable show to do it in, because that's very much what we're talking about with these ceremonies. And it's, I think, the whole subject of quantum mechanics is really key to the energetic nature of our cosmos and ourselves. There's the old, my favourite little joke about how the physicists have finally managed to scramble their way up the mountain of knowledge and sitting atop it. They found the Buddha, and the physicists have said, "What the fuck are you doing here?" And the Buddha's gone, "What took you so long?" It's a complex subject. A lot of books you have to read quite a lot of stuff to get any kind of handle on it at all. And Robert Anton Wilson, who was co-author with, I think, Kevin O'Shea, of a set of books called the Illuminati Trilogy, has, I think, written a very engaging little summary. And he called it Beyond Theology, the Science of Godmanship. And Synchro very kindly agreed to read it and record it a bit earlier in the week. So I was going to play it during the show anyway, so I might as well play it now, which will give me a bit of a chance to look through the chat box before I come back, hopefully, and have a look at one or two of the circuits and some of the words that are used to introduce this ceremonial technique. I think it's, like I say, I think it's justifiably called a technology, because we can actually demonstrate that change is being made. But in the meantime, here's Synchro, a voice that always goes down well on the Dr. Rock Show, reading a bit of Robert Anton Wilson. I'll be back with you in, I think it's 25, maybe 30 minutes, but a bit of quantum mechanics to show, because this very much underlies the kind of work that I'm talking about, I believe.
Beyond Theology, the Science of Godmanship, from the Illuminati Papers by Robert Anton Wilson. One day in 1909, Dr. Sigmund Freud and Dr. Carl Jung were arguing about extrasensory perception. Freud was insisting that all that stuff was nonsense, and Jung was arguing that there was something in it, really, although he didn't know what. As the argument heated up and the emotional energy began to crackle, there suddenly came an explosive bang from Freud's bookcase. "There," said Jung, "that is an example of so-called catalytic phenomenon." "Oh, come," Freud exclaimed, "that is sheer bosh." "It is not," Jung replied firmly, feeling possessed by an intuitive conviction he could not understand. "You are mistaken, Herr Professor, and to prove my point, I now predict that in a moment there will be another loud report." No sooner had Jung spoken than the same detonation went off again in the bookcase. Freud looked so aghast that Jung, who was a bit unsettled himself, dropped the subject at once. In his autobiography, Jung says that he and Freud never discussed the incident again. What are we to make of such a yarn? The skeptic will label it mere coincidence, or even more strongly, sheer coincidence, and forget about it. This does not really satisfy anybody but the skeptic himself. Parapsychologists will offer two alternative pseudo-explanations. Some of them will say that the bangs might have been caused by something as banal as seismic tremors in the earth or traffic in the street, and the paranormal aspect of the incident was just that Jung suddenly exhibited precognition, or the ability to see ahead in time. Other parapsychologists will suggest instead that what happened was psychokinesis, or PK, what laymen call mind over matter. According to this theory, Jung's unconscious somehow made the explosion happen. Those who believe in this explanation say it also accounts for poltergeists, a German word for noisy ghosts, who allegedly afflict some houses with crashes and bangs for months on end, and even make the furniture fly. The noisy ghost, they say, is emotional psychic energy accidentally unleashed by one of the people living in the house. The trouble with these explanations is that, like coincidence, they are only words. The term precognition does not tell us what any scientist would want to know, which is how Jung saw ahead in time, and the word psychokinesis does not tell us how Jung's mind caused the second boom. But there is an explanation for it, and for all other paranormal events you've read about, the spoon bending, the out-of-body experiences, the faith healers, and the explanation lies in physics. "I am inclined to believe in telepathy," Albert Einstein once said, "but I suspect it has more to do with physics than with psychology." When Einstein said this back in the 20s, nobody in either physics or psychology understood what he was suggesting. Today, new breakthroughs in a far-out branch of physics called quantum theory indicate that Einstein was, as usual, 50 years ahead of his contemporaries. These new discoveries seem to offer a single scientific explanation for all the weird events that parapsychologists have classified under such conflicting labels as ESP, direct brain perception, clairvoyance, distant viewing, psychokinesis, out-of-body experience, and cosmic consciousness or illumination. What some physicists are suggesting is that all such mystical brain functions are aspects of one phenomenon, a subatomic but universal intelligence system that receives, integrates, and transmits information at a level much deeper than the sensory appearances of what we call space, time, and separateness. And this intelligence system, although outside space-time as we know it, manifests itself within space and time as electrons, atoms, molecules, cells, complicated critters like you and me, planets, stars, and whole galaxies. So what is quantum mechanics? A quantum is a unit of action, just as a foot is a unit of length, or a gram is a unit of weight. Quantum physics first appeared as a theory in the 1890s when Philip Leonard observed that light travels in distinctly timed, choppy units like the beats of a drum, not in smooth, continuous waves like the singing of a violin. These distinct units are called quanta. The single unit is a quantum. The quantum theory is the body of experiment and mathematics dealing with such discontinuous actions. Furthermore, it is now known that all subatomic events occur in this quantum or jumpy manner, a miniature psychedelic light show. If the world of large things seen by our senses is like a straight line, the quantum world is like a dotted line. Or, to employ three artistic analogies, a painter would describe the quantum world as collage, not portrait. A musician would call it staccato, not legato. A filmmaker would say it was montage, not linear narrative. No cause and effect relationship has yet been found between one quantum action and the next. Most physicists are convinced that there is no cause and effect on that level. It is as if law and order function only above the atomic level, inside the atom. The surrealists, crapshooters, and anarchists have taken over the shop. To the ordinary citizen, everything in modern physics is as queer as a three-legged duck anyway, and this lack of causality in the quantum wonderland is no stranger than anything else physicists tell us. To the physicists themselves, quantum mechanics has done to traditional science what Sitting Bull did to Custer. One of the greatest quantum physicists, Nobel laureate Erwin Schrödinger, was so distressed by his own equations that he denounced this damn quantum jumping in a letter to Einstein. Science, you see, is supposed to be able to yield accurate predictions based on the iron law of cause and effect, and the breakdown of causality within the atom makes it look as if science itself may be an arbitrary human attempt to impose order on a disorderly or chaotic universe. Rising from the wreckage of causality, three lines of thought have attempted to make sense of the seemingly senseless facts. These are known as the Copenhagen interpretation, the multiple universe model, and the hidden variable theory. The Copenhagen interpretation was devised in the 20s by Nobel laureate Niels Bohr and named after his hometown, where he lived in the middle of the Carlsberg Brewery, in a house given him by the Crown. The breakdown of causality in quantum mechanics is expressed mathematically in the concept of the collapse of the state vector. You don't need to know what that means technically. Roughly, a vector is a mathematical expression telling you the direction and magnitude of a force. It is enough to know that in ordinary, large-scale mechanics, the vector tells you what will happen next, and in quantum mechanics, the state vector only tells you what might happen next. There is thus a great gaping hole between what science should be able to predict and what quantum theory does allow us to predict. Bohr filled in the hole by saying, the collapse of the state vector exists only in our minds. No, that is not a misprint, and no, I am not oversimplifying. Another physicist, Bryce DeWitt, tells us bluntly, the Copenhagen view promotes the impression that the collapse of the state vector and even the state vector itself are all in the mind. To the ordinary person who doesn't know the state vector from Finnegan's feet, this may not sound too alarming. But to traditional physicists, Bohr sounds like a man saying the brick wall you banged your head on is only in your mind. Bohr was not a solipsist. He didn't claim the state vector was only in his mind, but his theory does seem, at least to his critics, to imply a kind of group solipsism, a notion that the universe known to science is not a model of the real universe, but something once removed from that. A reflection of how the human mind goes about building models of the real universe. As Sir Arthur Eddington, an astronomer much influenced by Bohr, states this position, we have found a strange footprint on the shores of the unknown. We have devised profound and elaborate theories, one after another, to account for its origin. At last, we have succeeded in reconstructing the creatures that made the footprint, and lo, it is our own. The multiple universe model has its roots in science fiction, and some physicists think it should have been left there. It is, however, a logical and consistent alternative explanation of what the hell collapses that unpredictable state vector. Briefly, everything that can happen to it does happen to it. This is also known as the Everett-Wheeler-Graham model, having been devised by three Princeton University physicists, Hugh Everett, John Archibald Wheeler, and Neil Graham. I don't know what they were smoking at the time, but this view holds, in effect, that if you toss a coin, it lands both heads and tails in different universes. The state vector collapses every which way, as the actual quantum equations imply. We see only one result, because we are in only one universe. But in the universe next door, another you and another I will see a different result. And there are an incredible number of such possible, and by this fundamentalist reading of quantum math, real alternative universes. As Bryce DeWitt has written in Physics Today, I still recall vividly the shock I experienced on first encountering this multi-world concept. The idea of 10 to the power of 100 plus, slightly imperfect copies of oneself, constantly splitting into further copies, is not easy to reconcile with common sense. Indeed it is not, but DeWitt and others have accepted it as the least absurd way out of the quantum uncertainty problem. If you can deal with the idea that in the universe next door, Hitler is remembered as a popular artist who never went into politics, and in the next universe over, John F. Kennedy decided not to go to Dallas on November 22, 1963, and lived to a ripe old age, and in another universe you don't exist because your parents never met, you can take the multi-world path out of quantum anarchy. Otherwise, it is back to Copenhagen, where the universe we know is inside our heads, or onward to the hidden variable, where space and time do not really exist. The hidden variable theory was started by Albert Einstein, even though he never explicitly used the term hidden variable. Nevertheless, Einstein was always annoyed by quantum uncertainty and attacked quantum mechanics from every angle possible, summing up his view in the famous dictum, "God does not play dice with the universe." In 1952, Dr. David Bohm showed explicitly that Einstein's criticisms of quantum theory were valid only if there were a sub-quantum level, a world below the quantum world. Bohm also showed that this sub-quantum world could be the hidden variable that collapses the otherwise anarchistic state vector, but only if the supposed variable functioned non-locally. This means, in effect, only if space and time do not exist as we think they do. The trouble with the Copenhagen solution is that, however much Niels Bohr and his defenders may deny it, this path ultimately leads to the conclusion that everything we think we know is only a construct of our brains. Physics then becomes a branch of psychology. It tells us not what the universe does, but what our brains do in organizing their impressions and ideas. The trouble with the multiple universe model is that, however elegantly it may fit the quantum equation for the state vector, most of us simply can't believe in skillions and skillions of universes, each as vast in space and time as the one we think we're in, where everything that can happen really does happen. And the trouble with the hidden variable theory has always been that nobody dared claim they had found any subquantum world beyond space and time in which the hidden variables could function, until recently. As Niels Bohr said to a young physicist, "Your theory is crazy, but it's not crazy enough to be true." In 1964, Dr. John S. Bell published a demonstration that still has physicists reeling. What Bell seemed to prove was that quantum effects are non-local, in Bohm's sense, that is, they are not just here or there, but both. What this apparently means is that space and time are only real to our mammalian sense organs. They are not really real. This was the first step towards solving the mystery of Freud's exploding bookcase and similar enigmas of parapsychology, but nobody realized it immediately. The next step came, as is often the case in science, from three sources at once. In the early to mid-60s, Charles Muses, a mathematician interested in parapsychology, Dr. Timothy Leary, the LSD researcher, and Clive Baxter, a polygraph expert, who had been investigating ESP in plants, all proposed that consciousness does not reside in the brain alone. Rather, they all proposed that consciousness goes down to the cellular level, to the molecules, to the atoms, and maybe even deeper. The first to construct a complete quantum theory on this basis was Dr. Evan Harris Walker, a physicist working for the US Army in weapons research. Dr. Walker explains this theory in a paper written with Dr. Nick Herbert. The hidden variable theory of consciousness asserts that 1. There is a subquantal level beneath the observational theoretical structure of ordinary quantum mechanics, and 2. Events occurring on this subquantal level are the elements of sentient beings. This being the case, we find that our consciousness controls physical events through the laws of quantum mechanics. That couldn't possibly mean what it seems to say, could it? Yes, by all the pot-bellied gods of Burma, it means exactly what it says. Our consciousness controls physical events through the laws of quantum mechanics. We are the hidden variable, or parts of it. There hasn't been a more radical proposition since the Psalms proclaimed and Jesus repeated, "I said, you are gods," in John chapter 10, verse 34. Walker and Herbert have specifically applied this theory to psychokinesis, and here we are getting close to explaining Freud's exploding bookcase. Using an equation devised by Walker to predict the amount of quantum wobble that can be produced by the human mind, they have compared the results predicted with those actually obtained in one classic long-range investigation of the alleged PK function. The experiments were conducted by Harkon Forwald, a retired electrical engineer, from 1949 to 1970. Forwald's results exactly fit the prediction of Walker's equation. Subjects trying to control randomly falling cubes produced results as far above chance as they should have, according to Walker's math. Dr. Herbert has carried this line of thought one step further. Director of the Sea Life Institute, a conscious robot job shop, Herbert is a soft-spoken fellow who dresses like Einstein did, or a 60s hippie. He had developed Bell's theorem into the data of the cosmic glue, which holds, in effect, that everything is the cause of everything. The waters get pretty deep here, but fortunately the cosmic glue can be illustrated with amusing accuracy by an old Sufi joke. Nasruddin is out riding when he sees a group of horsemen. Thinking this may be a band of robbers, Nasruddin gallops off hastily. The other men, who are actually friends of his, say, "I wonder where Nasruddin is going in such a hurry," and trail after him to find out. Nasruddin, feeling himself pursued, races to a graveyard, leaps the fence, and hides behind a tombstone. His friends arrive, sitting on their horses, lean over the wall to ask, "Why are you hiding behind that tombstone, Nasruddin?" "It's more complicated than you realize," says Nasruddin. "I'm here because of you, and you're here because of me." In Herbert's cosmic glue theory, every quantum event is here because of another quantum event, which is here because of the first quantum event. At this level, causality is meaningless, and Herbert prefers to speak of influence, which acts every which way in time. All of us, past, present, and future, are bound non-locally by the cosmic glue. Dr. Herbert claims this is the only theory of quantum causality consistent with Bell's demonstration that cause and effect are non-local, and with the Einstein-Bohm claim that nothing in the universe is truly random. In case the full implications of the cosmic glue still haven't hit you, Herbert will tell you quite bluntly, consciousness, non-local in space and time, is the hidden variable. You ask at this point, if this is true, why don't we notice it? Why, that is, do we generally feel that our consciousness is located in one place, a few inches behind our foreheads? The physicists haven't tangled with this problem yet, but there are answers to be found in anthropology and psychology. In the first place, not all people feel that the consciousness is necessarily in the brain. The Chinese have always thought it was in the center of gravity of the body, and their ideogram for mind literally shows a heart and a liver, not a brain. Hindus and Sufis perform daily exercises of moving consciousness all over the body, from the toes and legs and torso onward to the top of the skull and back down again. In the second place, modern psychology has demonstrated that where and how we feel ourselves to be is conditioned by childhood experiences and is not based on any innate physiological seat of ego awareness. And finally, parapsychology and the study of other societies records ample cases of people who have experienced their consciousness as far, far removed from the physical brain. According to the cosmic glue theory, consciousness is everywhere and everywhen. We experience it here and now only because we are trained or brainwashed to experience it that way. There is a sharp disagreement among competent men as to what can be proved and what cannot be proved, as well as an irreconcilable divergence of opinion as to what is sense and what is nonsense, as Eric Temple Bell, the mathematician, said. Let us, as the Chinese say, draw our chairs closer to the fire and see what we are talking about. The story so far, the parapsychologists have accumulated a great deal of strange data about wild, bizarre behaviours of human consciousness. Although they have labelled these strange experiences with many names, the data all seem to reduce to the phenomenon of consciousness acting as if it were not imprisoned in the brain, as if it could migrate elsewhere occasionally, out-of-body experience, or as if there were non-sensory openings through which information from elsewhere can leak in. The quantum physicists, meanwhile, have found a subatomic jumpiness or randomness that cannot be reconciled with common sense ideas of cause and effect. Aside from saying the whole problem is in our heads, as in the Copenhagen interpretation, or that everything that can happen does happen in the multiple universe model, the most plausible theory that has been devised is the hidden variable theory, which together with Bell's theorem of cosmic glue suggests that consciousness is non-local, in space and time, not locked into the brain. The hidden variable theory is gaining ground because of its central assumption of non-locality. Bell's theorem has been experimentally confirmed 5 times since 1974. These experiments showed that 2 photons, or light particles, once in contact, will continue to react as if still in contact, no matter how far apart they are in space, exactly as predicted by Bell's math, and just as would be true if Walker and Herbert are right in claiming that quantum events are controlled by a consciousness which transcends space and time. In San Francisco, Dr. Jack Sarfati, president of the Physics Consciousness Research Group, has gone a step beyond Walker and Herbert. Below the space-time level of the universe we perceive, Sarfati says, is the subquantal world of minimum intelligences. Imagine them as microcomputers. They make up the hardware of the universe and are localized in space and time. Each is here or there, not both. But, Sarfati goes on, the software or programming is non-local in Bell's sense. The cosmic blueprint is here, then, and everywhere. Now, then, and everywhen. The hidden variable, Sarfati concludes, is not precisely consciousness, as Herbert and Walker think, but information. Information in modern science has a very special mathematical meaning, more specific than in ordinary speech. Without going into the math of it, information is coherent order, as distinguished from noise, which is incoherent chaos. Biological evolution is the gradual emergence of information out of chaos. To the biologist, it is information in the genetic code of the cherry stone that tells it to grow into a cherry tree and not a tea kettle. To the modern sociologist, information is the roads, customs, and traditions that mould random individuals into a society. If Sarfati is right, information is also coded into the quantum foam, telling it to grow into the universe of space and time we know. Imagine that your brain is a biological computer, as most neurologists now think. Imagine further that all subquantal events are also computers. Microcomputers, as Sarfati says. Imagine finally that the universe is also a computer, a mega, mega, mega computer. What Bell's theorem means, according to Sarfati, is that the hardware of this interlocking system of intelligent Chinese boxes, or computers within computers within computers, is localized in space and time. But the programming, the subquantal hidden variable, is everywhere and everywhen. This sounds suspiciously like a definition of God, because God is, according to all theologians, just such a non-local programmer, omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent. But if this information system is a kind of God, or a scientific analogue of God, it is also you and me and the lamppost. The information, remember, is non-local in space and time, so the whole universe and every particle in it partakes of the information, and is thus a co-creator of the whole, but on different scales. Is this not what pantheists have been claiming for millennia?
That was Syncro reading Beyond Theology, The Science of Godmanship by Robert Anton Wilson. And, wow, that's a really cosmic piece of stuff, isn't it? Thanks, Syncro, for reading that. She also asked me to apologise for her pronunciation of banal as banal, but one of the kitchen posse pointed out it's just be anal, which is fair enough. In passing, I'm not going to go into that. Hopefully I'll get a podcast for this up. I think there's a lot of material in there. In passing, there was a reference to a man called Baxter who was doing experiments with plants. And what he wanted to do, he was very interested in lie detectors and spent a lot of time developing them. And what he wanted to do was wire a lie detector to a plant and see whether it registered being watered and being hurt in any way. And amazingly, one of the first things he found out was that the watering thing didn't work very well. But as he only had to think about damaging the plant, about putting a cigarette lighter under its leaf, for the plant to show a response on the lie detector, which completely astonished him. And he then did a lot of very extensive experiments, which showed that plants not only respond to thoughts, threatening thoughts, but that when a guy called Inigo Swan came into the lab, he's quite a famous individual, the plants appeared to be able to spot when somebody was only going to think about it. They responded to start with, but eventually realized that the individual concerned wasn't actually going to hurt them, so they stopped responding. So that, if you really want, those are brilliant experiments. Again, they're in the intention experiment, I think. I've seen them summarized elsewhere, but I'm pretty sure they're in there. A load of very, very interesting stuff about how the thoughts of an individual and sometimes even the presence of a dog, a particular dog, can actually affect plants. And I remember Syncro telling me when she was in Mexico that at the banks there, they've actually got plants wired with electrodes because they're capable of detecting people who are walking into the bank in a state of stress. And their idea was that they could actually pick up on people who planned no good, as it were, from the responses of these plants that were stood either side of the door. Now that, I think, is a really good demonstration of how important what we do with our minds actually is. Also, I think the key quote in there was that consciousness controls physical events through quantum processes. We are the unknown variable. So all this stuff that we do is really important. And it's one of the things that my mind's been connecting with this ceremonial work for some time. We're still, by the way, trying to find out whether No Holds Barred are going to be on at midnight. And keep an eye on the host's room, around midnight to see if they are. But I've actually got loads more material than I need for a single show here. And it would be a bit of a shame to have to revisit it. So if No Holds Barred don't turn up and claim the stream, I'll carry on, if that's okay with everybody. I have, whilst Syncro was reading her piece there, I've been having a look through the chat box, and it seems that people have been very involved with the subject matter. And it has, quite remarkably, I think very synchronistically myself, it's fairly well in line with a few of the shows, as I pointed out earlier, that have been on PIR recently. So I'll just have a quick look through some of the highlights there. Rick Fields brought up the subject of Velikovsky, who, of course, I forgot to mention in my list of books that are associated with this. Velikovsky, of course, dealt with catastrophism and suggested that the entity that caused so much grief in the time of the Israelites, the plagues of Israel, basically, when they abandoned Egypt and Egypt just fell apart. It was basically the end of the old kingdom in Egypt, as far as we can tell. I've always been somewhat puzzled why Velikovsky chose Venus, because that was, I think, I'm sure somebody will put me right in the chat box, not that I'll be paying any attention. I think that was about 1500, 1600 BC, as far as we can tell. And it's quite clear that the Sumerians knew about Venus, so it's unlikely to have been born, so what, some 1500 years after they came to the fore, as it were, and maybe 2,500 years after they first popped up. So I think we did some shows on Velikovsky a long time back, and I do also do a bit of I include him in a presentation I do on catastrophism. And I've said right from day one on that one that I wasn't particularly attached to the idea that all Velikovsky's theories could be attached to Venus, and that as far as I was concerned, it might well have been Nibiru, or the beast he called Phaeton or Titan, or any of these other names it was given, Wormwood. It's just a bit strange that Velikovsky should have come up with so much brilliant stuff, and yet chosen Venus, which was, like I say, clearly recognised by peoples that were around a long, long time before those particular biblical events appear to have occurred. But hey, there you go. I think that many people who've got really good ideas and put forward very, very cogent arguments are sometimes wrong on one or two details. And of course, that's one of the things that the establishment uses to undermine good new data, is they will completely ignore all of the good stuff, they will pick on the bad stuff, and then mercilessly hack away at it, which quite often leads to 100-year gaps between things being actually discovered and them eventually reaching the public domain, as it were. Uniquely suggested that there might be an artificial mind behind all of this. Well, I think there was some sort of rough corresponding explanation in that bit from Robert Anton Wilson, in that the whole thing is information, the whole thing is a giant mind, and we're the mind, the dogs are the mind, and the lampposts are the mind. Also, on the subject of artificial minds, another thing that the template discusses at some length around ceremony 3 or 4, I think it is the moon, and where that came from, and what it is, because as Vin and Lee pointed out the other night, NASA have admitted that the moon rings like a bell, and Carl Sagan, normally an apologist for NASA, points out that it is not possible to have a natural hollow satellite. So when we look at the moon, we're without doubt looking at one of the most anomalous things known to man, as far as I can tell. That was another thing that I heard a lot about when I was on that Earth Spirit Camp, was there was a man there who had spent a lot of time studying the moon, and he had many, many pages of data on the various anomalous bits. In fact, it would appear that the harder you look at the moon, the more you realise that there's pretty much nothing about it. Pretty much nothing about it that's not anomalous. Rick Fields put in the chat box a long time back that he thought that maybe 2012 was a CIA mind control date. I wasn't actually going to go there. I was skirting around the subject, talking about 2012. But as far as I gather, it is something that I read a lot about. And it turns out that the man who is the main authority, orthodox authority on the Mayans, a man called Michael D. Coe, and he's written, I think, his book's now in its 6th edition. It is a great book, actually. It's got loads of brilliant pictures and loads of great ideas in it. But as far as I gather, he was one of the minds behind the December 21st, 2012 date. I can't remember the names of the other guys involved. And as far as I can gather, he was definitely an MI6 agent, so even if it's not CIA, MI6 can't be that far away. I see a couple of more comments in the chat box. I'm trying to do several things at once now. The captain's put, when are you going to pick up on ET-101 again, Rockstar? Good question, Captain. Probably whenever we find out which box it is that it's disappeared into. I still really like that book, although, once again, I'm not sure which side of the argument it actually falls on. Freeman Jack's put in, nice to see you, Jack. Hi there, matey. In my opinion, Velikovsky was spot on, but his reliance on typing up his theories with biblical mythos without factoring in the archaic source of the Jesus myth. Yes. Yep, fair point there. He was also pretty keen on, he had to come up with a new time scheme in order to make it all fit together. So, possible. Maybe the dating was wrong or something. And, because certainly it does appear that historically, as far as our mytho-history goes, Venus did spring from the head of Jupiter. So at some point, people do seem to believe that Venus was born out of Jupiter, which reminds me of another really useful source that I didn't include in my list earlier on, which is a book called Savage Genesis, which you've also discussed on the show. Savage Genesis, The Missing Page by Stan Hall, which looks at catastrophism and what he calls galactricity, his galactricity model. So it's a mixture of planets being born of other planets, as apples are born of apple trees, and electricity, which is right, bang on. There we go. Jack's put in the catastrophe was more like 150,000 years ago, not 1,000. And we do know these stories are moved backwards and forwards in time to make them fit in with whatever so-called apparently sacred ideas are being put forward. Lee's put in it's possible Earth has had many catastrophes. I totally agree with that as well. It seems to have happened many times, at least 5 or 6 times as far as we can tell. What else was in the chat box? Unique Lee and Mahatma Coates were playing with the name Pierre de Chardin, who turns up a lot in New Age references, and he was certainly one of the key influences on José Argüelles. And José Argüelles was one of the ones who took the Mayan calendar's traditional count and turned it into something that fitted really neat, much more neatly into a kind of the orthodox kind of box by ensuring that, well, didn't drift, because the traditional count does. What he did was he pinned it down, and he did that by ensuring that one day every 4 years, the leap year wasn't counted. Now, if there's one thing the Maya would not have done, it's not count a day, because that wasn't what they were interested in. Quite like the dream spell system, as it was called, but was suspicious of it because of that. And like I say, Pierre de Chardin was absolutely central to José Argüelles' work, and José Argüelles was a product of the Esalen Institute, which itself is probably the subject of a show all on its own. Lee put into the chat box, New Age sucks in suckers, which was certainly one of the things that was being discussed in those recent ceremonies that we went to in Glastonbury. And if you want to pick on a kind of inflammable place to pick on the New Age, then Glastonbury is a good place to do it, is all I can say. But hey, they seem to me to be absolutely fearless, these people. And of course, they are not alone. Mark Passio has got a set of, I think it's eight or ten, very interesting YouTube vids up about the nature of the New Age and just exactly how it's functioning. Somebody put in the chat box about where did all of these traditions come from? That is a very good question as well, and one that is also addressed in the various template workshops. Lee put, where did the Egyptians get their astrology from? There was a little bit of discussion of astrology and astrotheology in the chat box some time back. Lee, like I said, where did the Egyptians get their astrology? That, again, is a question that was addressed in our recent template workshops. And again, trying to tackle the New Age or tackle the moon, tackling astrology is something that can certainly get you into fairly hot water. But nonetheless, we are not in the business of saying just what people want to hear. We're in the business of trying to find out just what on earth it is that's going on here. And we are dealing with an apocalypse. We are dealing with an unveiling. And unveiling means that a lot of habitual thoughts, a lot of things that we've taken for true, and I know for me it's been nearly everything, turn out not to be true. So hey, why not that as well? There was a passing reference as well to Abrahamic Hebrew pharaohs. As far as I gather, we've actually got one of those on the throne at the moment. Again, came as a bit of a surprise to me, but there you go. I don't suppose anything should by now. And finally, Rick Fields puts, there's an idea that we are a projection of data information that's stemming somehow from a black hole. This business of being projection of data that's in a black hole, this is tied in with the Maya, who suggested that the light coming from the sun is information projected to us from the mind of light beyond the sun. And they identified, once they'd lost interest in the moon and the pole star, or specifically the pole star, where they concentrated most of their effort was on monitoring galactic center. They appear to have known that at the center of the galaxy is at least what purports to be a black hole from which sprung all the local stuff. So as far as they were concerned, we are exactly that, a projection of light that comes from the mind of light beyond the sun via the sun. It's also one of those points where the template ceremonies tie in really closely with Mayan ideas. Indeed, as far as I understand it, I think all of this material has arrived from pretty much the same place as the Mayan calendars, although it's very difficult to pin this down. And in the template system, the mind of light beyond the sun, i.e. galactic center, is the galactic pineal. The sun, through which light, information, whatever we want to call it, is being pulsed from galactic center, is the solar system's pineal, and of course it is to our pineal that all of this information is actually being pulsed. So, very interesting stuff in the chat box. I just picked a bit of stuff off the top there. There was also reference to Santos Bonacci in there. Really like Santos's work. There is an hour or so's interview that I had with him when we were at the Truth Juice gathering a couple of years ago. It was the first time I'd met him, and we really got on like a house on fire. I like the man a lot, and I really hope he's still free. The last videos I saw of Santos, he was being wrestled to the ground and ineffectively pleading with some Australian sheriffs. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know whether anybody did. Don't know whether anybody knows whether he got locked up or whether he hid away or what, but they seem to believe that he owed them an enormous amount of meaningless promissory tokens for some reason or another. Anyway, what I'm going to do now is, I've got a bit of time for that. I just want to have a quick look at, in a little bit more detail, at some of the stuff that was in that original ceremony, the Ceremony of Original Innocence introduction. The ceremonies themselves involve a spoken code, different code for each ceremony, which basically enacts stuff that is talked about in the presentations. I've talked a little bit about some of the presentations. I'll talk, if I get time, No Holds Barred are not on later. I'll talk about some of the later ceremonies a bit later in the show. If not, I'll save it for a later show. But there's a spoken code, and generally there is a series of pieces of geometry. As I say, until I did the second ceremony, which is where the geometry really pops up, I had absolutely no interest in geometry at all. And after a single day of being exposed to this stuff, I became a geometry nut. And it is still one of my major presentations. I still do an illustrated introduction to sacred geometry from the dot to hyperspace. No previous experience necessary, and it is the information from that second ceremony that I'm presenting there broadly, although I've expanded it. So there's a spoken code, and whilst the code is being spoken, you peer at bits of geometry, or, as we'll hear in the first ceremony, certain other items. And as a result, a series of circuits, electromagnetic circuits, are reconnected into the human biosystem, and that fact that that reconnection needs doing, the fact that there is weakness before the ceremony, can be demonstrated through kinesiology. Also, before the ceremony, you can demonstrate that reconnection can be made by using external props, like the geometry. And then, once the code and the geometry have been experienced, the muscle testing after the ceremony, before people leave, shows that the muscles are absolutely rock solid. And that happens even if you have slept through the ceremony, which is completely remarkable. Some people have been a bit amazed by the fact they've been too tired to pay any attention at all. They've simply been in the room where the ceremony is occurring and have ended up completely connected. You can also surrogate for people of your own bloodline. So if you've got parents or children or brothers and sisters, anybody that's connected with you by blood, basically, you can simply bring them to mind at the beginning of the ceremony. Then you don't have to hold them there any further. You can do the ceremony. And when you go home and test their muscles, you will find that they too have been connected. So there are many, many things about this particular system that are quite simply utterly, utterly uncanny. So, as I say, the one that I'd like to concentrate on, because it's such beautiful material in this particular show, is the first ceremony. One of the first things that's said at the very beginning of the introduction to the Ceremony of Original Innocence is that ceremonies are proclamations of unity, harmony, and cooperation, that they are an invitation to remember who we truly are, which, just in itself, if you weren't doing anything else, is worth bearing in mind when you think of the separation that is being constantly visited upon us through nationhood, through religion, even through different parts of a town. Even now, through different parts of a family. Children are being separated from one parent or the other. The parents are being separated. Anything that encourages unity, harmony and cooperation has to be worth the candle. And, I mean, what's one of the things that I wanted to say, we'll hear later that this thing is now available. This particular ceremony is available on a DVD. I'll put the links in the chat box when I have my next break, which means that you can get the DVD. You can just do the ceremony at home on your television. They've put all the codes up there. They put the geometry up there so you can watch it spinning. There's a little book that comes with it, which explains a lot of the background data much more than I've got time to go through. And of course, I can't remember how much it costs. I don't think I actually paid for mine. There's a couple of audio CDs in there as well. But however much it costs, it's well worth, if necessary, clubbing together with one or two of your neighbours. That means that you can watch it, you can reconnect these circuits yourself, then you can go and show it to other people or pass it on. And even if nothing else is occurring, if you feel that proclamation of unity, harmony and cooperation might in any sense be useful at this stage, then hey, here's a technology that some of you, and obviously not all of you, but some of you might want to take on board. It's also pointed out at the beginning of that first ceremony introduction that we heard all those years ago in the Earth Spirit Camp, that it is at this focal moment in Earth's history, poised as we are on the razor's edge between light and shadow, that we're able to make fulcrum decisions, decisions that impact upon every level of our being, and make conscious the knowledge that we are the source which generates all the experiences that we have. And with this realization, we step out of the pathological obedience that has led to our victimhood and into the light world of creatorship. We are the source which generates all the experiences that we have. Now, if recognizing and claiming our sovereignty is not described by that phrase, then I'd like to know what it is described by. And as for stepping out of pathological obedience that's led to victimhood and into the light world of creatorship, well, again, I just look at that and I think, well, I hear people talking about their experiences of doing just that in the physical world, more or less every time I download a load of people's internet radio podcasts. That is what's going on. Pathological obedience is what has been bred and conditioned into us. Victimhood has been the result, and we are stepping by taking responsibility for our own actions, by reclaiming our sovereignty into the light world of creatorship. Another thing that was in the very beginning of that very early ceremony, and this was, like I say, before any other ceremonies were imagined at all, many of you have probably extricated yourselves intermittently and to some degree from the net cast by the world management team, a net which minute by minute, day by day, threatens our survival in a reality which is based upon and stabilized by the decisions that we make through fear. That is another absolutely core message that comes out not only from peoplesinternetradio.com, but from many of the people who talk at Truth Juice. Many people who are making headway into the light world of creatorship is that the very first step is to conquer the fear. And it's also, you know, it's also the thing, as Jimmy Hagan pointed out in his interview, in his conversation with John McSee in that show just before Christmas, it's also something which once you start taking responsibility, once we start engaging with this monstrous world, then fear is one of the things that just fades away. Sometimes it can be a simple activity that does that. I've become very much aware that people who are managing to do one of the simplest, apparently simplest things, which is resist paying Babylon Broadcasting for its TV license, one of the first things they notice is that that success, the fact that that can be done relatively easily and with, so long as it's done correctly, with relatively few repercussions, is the start of the falling away of the fear. So that's one of the ones that I think is really key, that at the moment, this net that's cast by the world management team is threatening our survival, because we're in a reality which is based upon and stabilized by the decisions that we're making through fear. And if we stop making our decisions through fear and start making them through a sense of responsibility, then that is really, really going to start helping. Then we get to the bit about the Anunnaki and about the manipulation or modification of human genes. You have heard stories of powerful beings, and many of us have, who have, through organic manipulation, created a slave race. Then the important bit. This occurred only through our cooperation, as our souls yearned for experience to come to know the use and misuse of power, the better to choose love. And that is what we're doing here, folks, when I've seen it said before that the opposite of fear is love. And what we're doing is we're choosing to act out of love and out of compassion and out of peacefulness instead of acting out of fear, out of fear. And at least according to this, I love that idea. I love the idea that we chose this experience. And that, again, is something that we are told by many different schools of thought, that all of this is happening because we chose to come here. It is our mission at this time to do what we're doing. We're here at this time for a reason, and one of those reasons is because we chose to be here. And I am so pleased to see so much action in the physical world around me as being revealed on people's internet radio and various other places. Because 15 years ago, you'd have been hard pushed. People were doing the work. Let's be fair, people were doing the work 40 years ago. But the number of people now who are actually enacting the stuff that was described all those years ago in this introduction, I find utterly exciting. In fact, I feel empowered just reading through this and putting it out. And I'm really grateful to you all for being out there and listening. And then another really important point. These disempowering, manipulative beings are in our service. They're performing roles that are entirely consistent with the cyclic function of the age in which we find ourselves. I love that. I love the idea that, well, I mean, I know it's true. Probably, if I didn't feel I was being lent on, I'd probably still be hanging out with my feet on the windowsill with a glass of red wine and smoking weed. I would not probably be feeling nearly so motivated as I am to do either the radio show or to be doing the ceremony work. And I suspect that maybe that's true of many other people as well. It has been observed before that human beings operate best when they're under stress, or perhaps operate more creatively when they're under stress. The dark power holders have done their job well, but as the time draws near when their actions no longer serve creation, their influence upon us will no longer be tolerated. They will be called back to the heart of the all and nothing manifesting galaxy, where, by the grace of the supreme individuality, they will be duly rewarded as their sacrifice has been great. I remember hearing that for the first time, and I remember thinking, man, that is really tidy. I like that. And as time's gone by, I've realised that no matter how difficult it is being me down here on the bleeding, out here on the bleeding edge, it must be far more difficult to be somebody like your Adolf Hitler or your Georgie Bush or any of these people who can't just take a noseful of something interesting and hack off down the concert hall and see Motorhead, for example. You know, it is a sacrifice, and I like the idea that this sacrifice will be duly rewarded, because again, what we're after here is equanimity. It is really, really important, as well as getting rid of the fear, that we manage to divorce ourselves from this idea of an us and a them. Everybody's here doing what they need to do. Everybody's down here, one way or the other, making the sacrifices necessary to achieve whatever growth it is that we're here to achieve. And of course, if everything's connected with everything else, then the progress we make here will be echoed through every single bit of the cosmos. Every single part of the fabric will be affected by any progress that's made as a result of these processes. Welcome the signs of decay as the milestones of humanity's deliverance into another realm of existence, free of duality, for it is the nature of the cycle that creates this degenerative phase, and to honour and appreciate this phase is to celebrate the rotting fruit of our history as it expels the seed of a new life. See, it is possible to look at anything that appears that we have been trained to believe is negative, that we've been conditioned to believe is not in our interests, that we've been conditioned to believe is in somehow in antipathy to what we'd like to see going on. It is possible to look at it in a way which casts a whole new light on the whole thing. It may be time to scrutinize the deception being perpetrated on this planet, but it is never time to hold on to fear, anger, and grief, for these emotions will tarnish our intentions and defile our inspiration. If we can allow ourselves to see perfection even where we have been convinced that it does not exist, we will begin to integrate and synthesize the light and the shadow within ourselves more easily, moving beyond the addictive illusions of this third dimensional reality, not holding on to fear, anger, and grief. Brilliant, eh? To see all things as equal is the transforming element to be used by you, the alchemists in a coming age of balance. And is this not, folks, what we're all working towards? That's what we want, isn't it? We want balance. We are experiencing a huge lack of balance of any sort at the moment, it seems to me. But as was pointed out a little bit earlier, all of that lack of balance is simply pushing us, making us move in the direction that we need to move. And the further the balance appears to be going all right, the more people there are awakening to what is happening around them. So hopefully that gives you just a little bit of a taste of some of my favourite bits of that original introduction. The ceremony itself is basically in five parts. It's each associated with the classical elements. The water circuits are the first ones that are reconnected. And the water circuits are found, there are three of them. They are in the thymus, the xiphoid, and the creative process. I believe the creative process, the test point for it, for kinesiology, can be found at the base of the rib cage, where the ribs come together. The xiphoid, there's a little dent in, I think it's called your sternum, there's a little dent in the centre of the rib cage. That's where the xiphoid process, the test point for the xiphoid process is. That's rather a strange little thing, that is, that it's kind of like, it's like a little bit of divorced ligament that doesn't appear to have any kind of function as far as I can gather. I'm not sure what it was, and it's not at all clear what it is, but that's the second water circuit that's reconnected. And the third one is the thymus. The thymus is like is where T cells are manufactured. It's responsible for the maintenance of the immune system, and it's something that for some reason goes into atrophy at the point at which we reach puberty. So basically when our hormone producing systems, like the gonads and the ovaries and stuff, swing into operation, for some reason the thymus appears to go into atrophy, although it does maintain a steady supply and doesn't increase the number of T cells that are produced. I think it continues to produce a bit of a steady supply. Those are the three water circuits. The thymus is reconnected energetically simply as a result of reconnecting the other two. And those circuits are reconnected by looking at your own eyes in the ceremony in a mirror, which I think is really great. Those first three circuits are reconnected by looking within yourself, which is actually true of quite a lot of them. And the reconnection of these circuits is one of the things that I think is the effect of this is one of the things that's most commonly noticed pretty much immediately by people that experience this ceremony, and indeed any of the ceremonies. I think it's one of the clearest differences that arises in many people, and that is that there is it's a healing which concerns the distribution of power in personal relationships. What's said is, if relationships have been founded on the subjugation of either the male or the female potency, which many relationships that we see around us are, then as a result of this reconnection, those relationships begin to transcend this codependence and move towards the co-creative. That is something that I definitely personally experienced, as did Synchro. We've seen it again and again. If the framework of a relationship, once laid bare of its dysfunctions, is no longer able to provide the infrastructure needed, it may well dissolve. One thing it will not do is house denial. One of the characteristics of denial, I believe, is looking away. One of the deeply embedded aspects of denial is what we call the slide response, the ability to just turn one's attention away from something that one finds is difficult to manage, difficult to accept, and just not pay any attention at all. So in a sense, denial stands in opposition of taking responsibility. And that is definitely something that occurs. And it's not, I found, not just the distribution of power in personal relationships that changes. It's the distribution of power in relationships generally. It becomes perhaps a little bit more necessary to speak one's mind when one knows one's mind needs to be spoken. That doesn't mean to say that one always speaks it, because there are some people who are become deeply distressed at knowledge that they're just not ready for. It is, as we have said before, like trying to wake somebody up who's fast asleep by pouring a bucket of iced water over them. But if they're already kind of waking up, then is the time. But inside ourselves, the denial starts to evaporate. Still, we have to do, as Juliet pointed out in our recent workshop, she pointed out that there is an element of creative denial every now and then. Well, quite often, frankly, we find ourselves in a position where we're needing to think about something for which we definitely do not have the solution, and it might be giving us a bit of problem. And that's the kind of thing that can be kind of put on the shelf, but it's recognised as a problem. Again, the denial is starting to break down. You've put it to one side to consider taking responsibility for it when you feel you have some way of doing that. And again, this has many analogues in the approach that we have at People's Internet Radio. There are solutions to things that are available to some people who have the skills and the knowledge to enact those solutions. Maybe to the beginner, these solutions are not immediately apparent, and we need to pick our battles. That if we're not in a position to deal with a situation elegantly without getting ourselves in any trouble, then sometimes it might just be better to pay the fine. But again, that I think is awakening from denial, because you're realising, you're making a choice. You're saying, this I can deal with, and I'm going to step beyond the boundaries of my fear, and I'm going to try and deal with this one. This one, I don't want to lose my machine. I can't afford to lose my machine, so on this particular occasion, I'm going to pay the 60 quid. But now this has happened, I'm bloody going to find out how to deal with it next time it does. So that is really, really one of the most important and basic things about this first ceremony, and particularly about the water circuits, is this business of distribution of power. The mirror that reconnects these circuits represents, it has an alchemical, it's an alchemical representation of forgiveness, which is another thing that we see emphasized again and again in the more enlightened texts. And it's basically forgiveness is described as a fundamental forward movement towards the integration of light and shadow within, because without it, we run aground in the stagnant waters of our own judgment and denial. And that is it. Many of the things we see in the world are actually projections from ourselves. The things that we think are being done to us are actually coming back to us as a result of what we're putting out there. Again, something that I can't really go into at this moment, because this subject for half an hour stuff on itself. But I'm sure many of the people listening to the show have already realised this, that the way you approach people, the way we approach people, it to a great extent determines the way they are going to approach us. So in a way, what you're forgiving is, what we are forgiving is our own behaviour that's being reflected to us from other people. Forgiveness is an emotional, intellectual and biological signal sent to yourself that you understand that all behaviour makes perfect sense. And in that way, every interaction then becomes a mirror reality, for it is the mirror, the watery element of reflection, that breaks the spell of blame. It is seeing our part in the dynamic that really makes forgiveness unnecessary. And again, this is equanimity, isn't it? It's seeing that the behaviour of the other is every bit part of the fabric of the reality, every bit part of what's going on, as our behaviour is. What we're dealing with is men and living souls incarnate, dealing with the world the best they can. Forgiveness is not, Juliet says, a selective choice, but a way of being. Can you say, I shall forgive this, but that is unforgivable? To deem anyone unforgivable is to stand in opposition to the omnipotent heart of creation, from which springs forth all. Because if we were the individual that say we feel a need to forgive, if we were in their position, if we had their parents, if we had their education, if we had their brothers and sisters, if we'd had their teachers, then to suggest that we in their position would be doing anything different from what they're doing is folly and denial. And that is why it's said that forgiveness, without forgiveness, we run aground in the stagnant waters of our own judgment and denial. Well, I see that it has reached 23:51, and I have got so much more stuff to say. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to put on a couple of tunes. I'm going to go and see if No Holds Barred are coming on at midnight. If not, we might take this a little bit further, though I can't see that we're going to make our way all the way through it in the immediate future. We'll see. I'm quite surprised by that, actually. I'm quite surprised by how much of this there is. But you can tell, at least I hope you can tell, that I'm well enthusiastic about it. I hope that the beauty of some of these words as well, and the similarity between what it is saying and what we are now doing in the real world, is striking some chords with you. But in the meantime, whilst I have a look and see what's happening in the People's Internet Radio.com hosts room, I'm going to put Dead Heart Bloom on and a track called New Messiah, because we are the new messiahs. You're listening to People's Internet Radio.com, and this is Dr. Rock's radio show. overrunning a little tonight. No sign of No Holds Barred at the moment. It'd be great if they do turn up, and I'll try and keep an eye on the chat and seed the stream if necessary. But in the meantime, I'll continue with what I was doing. We just had a brief chat about redistribution of power in personal relationships, about overcoming fear and anger via the water circuits, which are reconnected in the ceremony by looking in a mirror, which represents forgiveness. It's funny, actually, how many people have not actually looked at any depth into their own eyes in a mirror. There's generally quite a lot of giggling at that particular point, and it is in itself a moment of revelation to many of the people who come to the ceremony. And actually, even more strange, is that if you turn up at the ceremony of original innocence with your partner, you don't have to use the mirror. You can look into each other's eyes, and that reconnects your circuits as well. And also we discovered subsequently, although not in the early years of the first ceremony, that looking at an icosahedron, which is the Platonic symbol for water, also works, and that's what's used in the DVD. What we generally do is give people mirrors or let them look in each other's eyes, and we hang up an icosahedron. We have these beautiful geometries that are made up of they're like welding rods, but they're really carefully put together, so they're perfectly formed and very beautiful things to watch spinning. The second part of the five parts of this ceremony are the air circuits. There's four of them. People will recognise all of these as pretty major chakra and or energy points. They are the four circuits, the test points for them, the kinesiology test points are at the throat, the third eye, the crown, and the auric, which is about hand's width above the crown. So it's a bit of an etheric one, that. And these ones also are reconnected by looking at your own eyes in a mirror, or at the eyes of your partner, or in this case, looking at an octahedron, which is the Platonic sign for the classical element of air. It also represents nowadays prana. These are both subtle means of taking on board energy. The air comes in from outside, and I gather that the prana is generated within, although I have very little understanding of that. What's said in the introduction about that, I'm going to skip through this fairly rapidly. There is a lot more to this than I'm actually getting to put across at the moment, but when these circuits are activated, you'll not only be able to feel your unity with and love for the source of your creation, you will see it. You will see pulsating rhythms fusing in a molecular dance beneath the surface of everything in a celebration of life. There will be no shadow, and there will be no fear. And that always reminds me of Juliet's story of one of the initial experiences that led to all of this stuff happening. They used to be very different people, and the story of how all of these things occurred and arose and what went on before can be found in Juliet's book, which is called The World Bridger, and a very fascinating story it is, and yours truly helped to edit that book, which was a great task in itself. But this business of there being no shadow and there being no fear, I'm pretty convinced that that is the natural state of affairs. It always reminds me of that biblical phrase, and the lion shall lie down with the lamb, or as Woody Allen would say, but the lamb won't get much sleep. The experience that Juliet and Jeeva had was a match type encounter with an alien entity on a place called, I think it was on Green Mountain in Hawaii. It was a pretty terrifying experience when it was actually occurring, and led up to an encounter with a helicopter that turned up. And at that point, I believe they sort of dimensionally shifted again, the kind of thing we heard talked about on a match quite a lot, and were suddenly in a place where everything had its own inner light, where instead of the light coming from outside and reflecting off things to show you grass and plants and all that sort of stuff, what was happening was everything had its own inner light. Everything was cast in light, which meant there was literally no shadow. So those are the air circuits. Another important part of the air ceremony is that between the third eye and the crown is the pineal gland, which turns out to be pretty crucial in this first ceremony. The pineal hypothalamus pituitary setup, which is a major hormonal grouping in the brain, are seriously affected by the reconnection of those circuits and by circuits that come up in subsequent ceremonies. The next ceremony that occurs in this five-part ceremony is the Earth ceremony, which I've already talked about a little bit earlier in the show. It's reconnected by looking at an Earth crystal during the ceremony, or by looking at a cube, which is a platonic symbol for the Earth. It comes in, as I say, at the back of the head, about three fingers above the soft bit where your spine enters your brain, and it then circles around and enters about 16 or 18 inches into the Earth. And what it basically does is starts to re-establish a mycelium of consciousness, Earth consciousness in the human, and human consciousness in the Earth. Part of this dynamic is the fact that we have a tendency to believe that heaven is up above us and hell is below us. And we also have a tendency to believe that spirit is what we're aiming for and matter is somehow a degraded form. And it's that basic belief which is enabling so much damage to be done, not only to the planet, but to all the creatures that are on it. And the reconnection of this particular circuit starts to affect that particular dynamic. I think one of the things that came about for me with this was that I just suddenly became a vegetarian. It was completely unlooked for. I really wasn't expecting it at all. I just woke up one morning and I no longer wanted to eat meat. Since then, I've been becoming ever more sensitive to letting spiders go and all that kind of loads of things, loads of really kind of basically Buddhist ideas, I guess. But slowly but surely, by reconnecting these circuits, we're kind of making a covenant between ourselves, the world in which we find ourselves, and the other humans, the other beings that are around us. And slowly but surely, we begin to move away from, call them addictions, we call them habits of mind. They're infiltrating almost every impulse, thought process and action. And stepping outside them, hopefully, kind of improves our lives and the lives around us. What's said about the Earth circuit is that at this time, we share a morphogenetic field with those that instigate and carry out ethnic cleansing. We set our watches to the same measure of time that wakes the generals from their slumber. Our clocks tick to the marching feet of armies as multiple wars are waged upon the face of the planet, something that is very, very clear to us. But you know, it's invisible to many people that so much fighting is going on, that for as long as we've been around, we seem to have been fighting the Spanish or the French or fighting in Europe or fighting in Afghanistan, fighting in Vietnam, that I've no idea how many wars are being waged at any one time. But they're getting longer as well. I'm told that the war in Afghanistan is the longest war that America has ever waged. And one of the results of that war appears to have been that Afghanistan is now turning out more morphine, more heroin than it's ever done before. The poppy crops are absolutely massive. And as is pointed out in this introduction to the Earth ceremony, amidst all this, we can no longer chase the shallow dream of happiness, honing our abilities to maintain our own ever-expanding comfort zones. There's an indication here that what really is needed is community and sharing, that the ever more voracious gobbling up of Earth's resources and the hoarding of material wealth is what is causing the huge inequalities and what's making it so difficult for those of us who would like to live peaceful and productive lives, exploring these many new technologies and relationships that we should be developing. They're all being encouraged by the fact that, for one reason or another, our own comfort zones have become absolutely central. Is it really necessary to have billions of fridges so that everybody's got one, everybody's got a washing machine, everybody has to run all the electricity to run all of these things? And again, over the years since we first encountered this material, that has just gone on and on and on. There was a time when all we had was an outside kludgy, nobody had an inside bathroom, and then it became necessary, it is a planning requirement now, to have an inside bathroom. And one bathroom is no longer enough. Many houses, homes now have two or maybe three bathrooms. Hotels have ensuite bathrooms, so basically in your more high-class hotels, there's as many bathrooms as there are bedrooms, all requiring all the plumbing and the water and the copper and the electricity and the extraction fannage and all that other stuff that's necessary to make a modern bathroom work. And it's not a matter of choice. if you're going to live up to the planning, the requirements of the planning process, then you have to have one of these things. Otherwise, your dwelling will not be classified as a dwelling. And that's what the Earth Circuit basically addresses, is our attitudes to the Earth, to its resources, and to each other. And I think it's possibly one of the more important things. What we generate is slow but sure changes. I think it's possibly important to suggest that these changes vary from individual to individual. Some people change really pretty quickly. Other people, it takes a bit of time. These things kind of unfold organically from within. And they depend very much on the situation we find ourselves in. So it can be that if you're going to go home to a place that you don't like living, into a job that you don't like doing, eating food that you don't feel is suitable, accessing health systems that you know are not doing you any good, reading news which you know is simply making you angry, the list is really pretty endless. None of these things are a problem in themselves once we recognise that changes need to be made. One of the changes I've noticed over the last 15 years or so is that many, many more people do not have a television. That's, I think, a very, very significant change. And that is the kind of change that I would expect to see in people as a result of the reconnection of this particular circuit. Physically, we'll no longer be able to sustain our molecular structure by the taking of life in any form, as the human matrix is altered to a heightened awareness of its interconnectedness with all creation. Energy will then be directly assimilated through the sacred breath as we internally manufacture in the alchemical laboratory of the human temple the elixirs of life. This is one of the things that apparently before our disconnection we could do quite naturally. It's also, this is one of the bits I remember thinking, oh, well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, how far away are we from being able to not eat food and just live on light? And then, of course, I started looking a little bit into sun gazing and realizing that there are people out there who definitely can do that. There are many people who claim to, and I'm sure now myself that some of them are actually doing this, but there are certainly well-documented cases where people have been kept under medical supervision and for over a year. I know one of the cases I read about, there was an individual who lived, I think, for somewhere over 400 days, and he was not only under medical supervision, he was actually being watched by the American military. And as far as anybody could tell, in those 400 days, he took on board practically no food and very little water, and the water he did take on board was for social reasons. So it is possible, at least an individual can, as demonstrated, that it is possible to live on light. And if I remember rightly, there were measurements being taken of this man's pineal as well. And his pineal, unlike the pineal in most humans, was not kind of a shrunken walnut-sized thing, but was kind of plump and smooth and about the size of a plum. And we remember what we were saying earlier, that the pineal is kind of the onboard version of the sun, and the sun is the solar system's version of the mind of light beyond the sun in the heart of the galaxy. We realise that it's possible that information, as the Maya said, is being integrated in a thoroughly useful way. As the pituitary, the hypothalamus, and the pineal are reconnected and returned to their original design, we will discover our synergetic interaction with the cosmos, understanding its influence upon us, not through historically gathered data, but by the direct assimilation of starlight. Because, of course, it's not only our local sun that's emitting light. Every single star that's out there is emitting its own unique electromagnetic signature. And we are apparently, in our original form, sensitive enough to understand, to comprehend, and to take on board all of this information, being, as we are, holographic fractal parts of a holographic and fractally constructed system. The fourth of the five parts of the Ceremony of Original Innocence reconnects the fire circuit, which is one of the main ones. This was one of the ones that I quite astonished myself with when I was testing it out at a healing ceremony, not a healing ceremony, at a healing fair. I was standing there with a poster saying, "Are you connected?" And I had this nice glossy poster of where all the circuits were. And I was inviting people to come along and just testing members of the public, really, which is a pretty brave thing to be doing, really. Again, it worked really well. But the first guy that turned up was, he was a Gurkha, because the healing fair was near Bracken, and that's where the Gurkhas are stationed. and he had arms like tractors, and he was small. He wasn't as tall as I was, but he was very heavily built. And the fire circuit is normally the one that I go for first, because it is one of the circuits that tests really weak. And, so I showed this man how the kinesiology worked, got him to hold his arm out, and got him to look at the roof in the building that we were in, and just put a little bit of pressure on his wrist. And he was one of those people who responded really well to the kinesiology. It wasn't that there was a small twitch in his arm. His arm just kind of went gently down to his side. And again, I got the kind of widening of the eyes as he kind of looked at this skinny hippie that was kind of, exerting a tiny bit of pressure on, like I say, an arm that was basically like a tractor. And then got him to turn around and look at a candle, and, I could probably literally have done chin-ups on his arm, I reckon. I really don't think that he would have even noticed my weight. And you can do, like I say, look at a candle flame, test strong, look at the roof of the building, test weak again. And, same thing, show him a tetrahedron, and because tetrahedron is the classical, representation of fire, he tested strong again. Very, very interesting. As I say, my experience over the last 15 years has been absolutely littered with experiences like that. Results that really far outshine my expectations, even though I'm thoroughly behind the entire technology. One of the things, this is, the fire circuit fundamentally addresses levels of fear. At this time, Juliet says, in this dimension, on this planet Earth, the inhabitants, regardless of their adopted philosophy, are broadcasting a vibrational message of fear, a message that reads, I am afraid. I'm afraid of annihilation. I'm afraid of eternal separation from all that I love. I'm afraid of death. And this is true. I've noticed it in chapelgoers and churchgoers that although, in theory, they have the idea of an eternal life coming after this one, that many of them don't seem to gain any kind of confidence from this at all. And it is because, I'm sure, of the conditioning and because of the training and because of the fact that we are made frightened by so many of the things that are going on around us. And as Rupert Sheldrake suggested, there is a morphogenetic field that takes on a bigger version of this. So as this wave of fear is broadcast from a few thousands of millions of units of circuitry, a mirror image of this reality supports its validity all over the world, which is why it works so well. And it is thus that we find ourselves collectively stabilizing a morphogenetic field that forms a cocoon of belief in which the dormant immortality of humanity never finds its wings but dies over and over again. This is another topic that is addressed by the template ceremonies, is this idea that we once lived a lot longer than we do now. Indeed, perhaps we were once immortal and can be immortal again. And indeed, again, perhaps if we're not chewing on physical food, if we're no longer living in a world in which in order for one thing to live, another thing's got to die, then the whole dynamic might change. So that's the fire ceremony, reconnected by peering at either a candle flame or a tetrahedron. There's, in the final part of the ceremony, the ether ceremony, there are three circuits. They're in the solar plexus, the heart, and the pubic circuit. And down the bottom of the abdomen is where the seat of the human power is. And this is where we deal with power issues. It's this particular circuit basically reconnects us with the heart of light, the mind of light beyond the sun, the heart of the galaxy, and reattunes us to the kind of divine plan. The heart is another circuit. This particular one tries to evoke the invitation of the purity of our souls to represent our human expression, to embrace and empower love to take precedence over all other alliances and agendas. This is something that some people manage to achieve quite naturally. And again, it's a bit like the stories we hear about blessing people, that when one is giving out blessings instead of curses, then the world around us completely transforms. I remember reading in a book, I can't remember the name of the author, about a lady who decided that she's going to be blessing people instead of cursing them, giving them a hard time. She was going to figure, oh, well, hey, if I lose something, it's obviously because I don't need it anymore. And this man tells the story that one stage at a London railway station, somebody snatched her handbag and made off down the platform with it. And she just issued a silent blessing to this bloke who kind of stopped dead in his tracks, turned round and gave her handbag back. Once again, if we think back to Baxter's work, just thinking about damaging a plant, causing it to respond, how much more sensitive might the human mind be to these kind of light impulses, which is what they appear to be. And it can result in a response. Also associated with the heart circuit is, I think, one of the most beautiful bits of particular description, this introduction, if you like, which points out that the courage needed to crusade against the many apparent injustices of this world age pale against the commitment needed to face one's own shadow. The bravest warrior with the sharpest sword is the one who can cut away all that impedes his or her progress towards unconditional love. The battle dress of today's servant warrior is the seamless garb of grace and refinement that adorns the one who can integrate and synthesize the light and shadow within. And I find an analogue of that in People's Internet Radio as well, and indeed in the old Clash song, Get Off the Streets. Protesting against all of the injustices in the world takes courage, but how effective is it? How ready are we to face the one in the mirror when we've shouted enough slogans and sung enough songs and are prepared to face the one in the mirror? That is when we will become a brave heart indeed. And that, again, is definitely what we're trying to do by stepping into our responsibility, by taking responsibility for what's going on around us. The final circuit reconnected in that particular ceremony is the pubic circuit, and that particular one is all tied in with the story of Adam and Eve and the disconnection of woman from her divine procreative power and all of that. And what's said about that is that our bodies are the living mandala of love on which is based the fundamental human ethic to give and receive love in all that we do. When that body is disconnected on its most basic level, its electromagnetic matrix, all else follows, and our frequency magnetizes the forms that mirror that disconnection. So it's one of the most fundamental ones, that is, in building the world that we see ourselves in. The template is an attempt to redress some of the damage that has been done and is being done as a result of our habitually addictive, dualistic thought processes that lead to fear, that lead to a lack of equanimity, that lead to believing there is something being done that needs to be forgiven. And if, as many shamanic peoples believe, all individual experience of life is ultimately uploaded to an oversoul at the end of each cycle of manifestation, or if, as I said, Rupert Sheldrake suggests, everything that happens becomes part of a bigger field, a morphogenetic field, a mass human consciousness, which informs the way in which things become manifest as the cycles continue, then I would have thought any game that recognizes, acknowledges, and makes energetic efforts to address the horrors of the preceding millennia is, well, at least in my opinion, it's got to be worthy of consideration. Nowadays, we know that the gods are frauds. We know that they're basically planetary bodies. They're basically stories. They're anthropomorphized stories of things that were seen going on in the night sky. We know that these cosmic happenings were misrepresented by priests who chose to put themselves between us and the Creator. And this knowledge should not be forgotten. It's possible that this is the first time that that information has become apparent to large numbers of human beings. And whatever it is that happens, whether Nibiru's come in or not, whether we are approaching another extinction-level event, whether that's unavoidable or not, remains a point in question if we are in fact beings of light and not actually totally trapped in these bodies. But if it's going to come along, and what's going to arise is another new arising on this beautiful blue ball, then the more of this information that can be embedded in the morphogenetic field, and the more our actions, our equanimity, our fearlessness, our love for each other, our compassion can actually be embedded both by our actions in the physical world, as is being shown by the people at People's Internet Radio, and possibly by energetic work, by meditation, by doing ceremonies like this one, then it's got to be worth considering, hasn't it, folks? So, like I say, there are people going around offering these ceremonies. We have recommitted ourselves, myself and Synchro, to doing a lot more of this work. We've been sort of steadily chipping away at it over the last few years or so. But this year we really do hope to get out there and do a lot more of it. We're going to be at the Tribal Conscious Camp at the end of July, doing this ceremony. We're also seeking to go to private homes, as I say, which is where, private dwellings, which is where we really prefer to do this, because that way we don't have to hire a hall. When we do this work, we also like to provide a wholesome food, if possible, of organic soup and bread, and if it's about, if it's timely, salad and the like. And that is something we're going to be doing and seeking places to do. But, as I said, the easiest way of getting at the Ceremony of Original Innocence right now is through the DVD that's been made, which seems to be remarkably effective. I've come across many people out in the festivals and stuff who've seen the DVD and who've done the work and it's worked really well, because of course we can do the muscle testing on them and we can find out that they have in fact been just as surely connected as if they'd been in a room with physical representatives or whatever, giving them all of this information and showing them the muscle testing and doing the work with them. Having said that, many people have come to us who have done the work with the DVD and have decided that that'd be a good idea to do it in meat space, which I think is another important aspect of the ceremonies. Like any workshop, it is an opportunity for people to come together who would not necessarily have met each other. And in my experience, these days of celebration always very, very quickly take on a really jubilant character of all of their own. And I suspect that in nearly all cases, long-term relationships are set up between the people who come along to celebrate these events. So one of the things that really attracted me to the Ceremony of Original Innocence was the fact that it was a one-off, really beautiful, really simple technology for addressing all sorts of internal habits and addictions, and for making fundamental changes with really very little effort. And there was quite a lot of resistance from me, certainly, I think, when it all started to get a lot more complicated. However, our experiences in Glastonbury at the beginning of December last year really, really seriously put that to rest, as I see what it is that's evolved from this, which isn't really something I think that could have been guessed at either by the people that participated in those early ceremonies or by the people that were responsible for bringing them to light, for bringing the geometry and the codes to such a state where they can be used pretty much infallibly. But like I said, I'm going to play another couple of tunes. We'll kick off with Call Me the Breeze. Yeah, Call Me the Breeze by Leonard Skinner. That was Catatonia and Don't Need the Sunshine from their fabulous album International Velvet. Well, I hope tonight has gone some way to encouraging people to think a little bit about the role of ceremony. Oh, another thing, I mean, apart from getting people together and apart from being a proclamation of unity and intent, it is, of course, completely apparent to us that the World Management Team are very, very much using ceremony as a means of maintaining the status quo, from the ceremonies that are being run at Bohemian Grove through the ceremonies that are being done in various Masonic lodges all over the globe, to the ceremonies which are basically court cases and all of the rest. It is one of the basic means that is most certainly being used to keep us in the state of slavery that has arisen over the last several thousand years. Whilst I was looking for the link for the DVD, I discovered that since I looked at the website last, it is now, as well as the DVD being available, there are a whole set of really beautiful little videos that introduce the template ceremonies as a whole. There are some fabulous little animated geometries there as well. But best of all, I've discovered that they've actually put up a version of the ceremony which you can actually run on Vimeo, so that people don't actually have to pay the money, they don't have to get the DVD or anything. That should make it available to everybody who's got access to the website. So it's at their homepage, thetemplateorg.com. I shall just paste the address here into the chat box. It's templateorg.com/template_DVD.php for those of you who aren't in the chat box. That gives you a chance to see some of the geometries that they're working with or animations of them, and it also gives you the opportunity to participate in the ceremony without it costing anything at all, which I think is that's really great. What a great move. One of the things that's very important about this is we believe that critical mass is important. The more people that get themselves connected, the easier it's going to be for other people to start making the changes that need to be made without probably ever encountering the template anyway. So there we go, www.thetemplateorg.com/template_DVD.php, and that should give you access to the ceremony free and for nothing. Thetemplateorg.com is a very interesting website. It's got lots and lots of testimonials, what people say about it. You can go and have a look at all the geometries that are being made to back all of this stuff up, the things that we use in the ceremonies to make them work properly. So I'd like to thank peoplesinternetradio.com for being there. I think they are a major solution themselves. I think, again, the variety of amazing stuff that's available on the podcast page cannot be overstated, really. It's difficult to find time to listen to anything else, to tell you the truth. There is a donate button at peoplesinternetradio.com. The website, I'm told, is secure and covered, but it does, even though everything's voluntary and being done for the love of it, it does take money, meaningless promissory tokens, to keep the whole thing on the road. I myself have recently benefited from a donation from PIR, for which I'm really grateful, because we were otherwise standing some chance of losing Dr. Rock's podcast page, because it's getting very difficult to cover everything that needs to be covered. I really need to start living on sunshine myself, to tell you the truth. That being the case, I am running out of space on my podcast page as well, which is a bit of a pain, and I'm needing to try to cover buying myself some extra stuff. So there is actually a donate button on the Dr. Rock page as well. I really didn't think I was ever going to have to do that, but I have, so I'm going to paste the link for that in there, just in case anybody's got a few gaming tokens they might like to donate to the project. It would go towards expanding the podcast page so that I don't have to take down any of the stuff that's already up there. I've trimmed it as much as I can, and I am, as far as possible, trying to reduce the size of the podcast without compromising their quality. But my website's not on www. It's on a secure server, https://internetradio, all one word, /dr-rock.biz/downloads. If anybody feels like handing me a few coppers, I would be more than grateful. I apologise for begging so unashamedly, but hey, you know how it is, folks. So thanks to PIR for being there. Thanks to all of you for listening. And I guess a big thanks to the template, who've really turned out to be more than I could possibly imagine them to be. All of the work has been well worthwhile, and especially the recent stuff, which, like I say, whilst being pretty hairy for some people because of the challenges it's raising for them, Synchro and I found to be utterly satisfying. We've got no complaints at all, and really look forward to continuing to participate. That's about it for another week. Bit of a marathon show there. I've just realised that you don't actually have to have the S at the end of the HTTP colon. In fact, my webmaster tells me if you get a warning from the world management team advising you that this address is for an untrusted site, it's because we haven't paid a recognised security authority to buy a certificate, as is self-signed rather than being endorsed by major governments. So it's probably more trustworthy than many officially certificated locations on the web. But you can actually get away with putting simply http://internetradio.dr-rock.biz/downloads if you want to either get some downloads or give me some of your money. There we go, there's a new link in there. In fact, I think you might even be able to just put in the internetradio.drrock.biz/downloads, and that might work too. It's all a bit of a mystery to me. In the meantime, that's about it from me. Thanks to all of you for listening there. Here's Dr. Feelgood. If people ask where you've been till this time in the morning, tell them you've been down at the doctor's. See you next week.